This is the inaugural episode of 5x5 at the Movies. I'm Dan Benjamin, host of the show and co-host of a number of other shows here on 5x5.tv. I'd like to welcome you to this program, the genesis of which really came from some of our other shows, where we've wanted to or even have talked about some of our favorite films, but didn't really have a venue outside of the context of those shows in which to talk about them, and had the idea that, you know what, maybe there should be a separate show that we record, well, whenever we feel like it. Maybe that means once a week, maybe it means once a month, so there's no promises as to the schedule for the show, but what I will promise is that we'll do a number of these, and we will bring on the hosts from the other shows and maybe special guests too to come on and talk about our favorite movies. Today I'm here with Hypercritical co-host John Siracusa, and we are going to be talking about Goodfellas. This one has been a long time coming. John Siracusa has been ready to talk about Goodfellas for how long now? Like a year?
Since almost? The day I was born.
The day you were born, you've been waiting for this.
That's right.
So if you're not a regular listener to Hypercritical, you know, obviously, shame on you, but John Siracusa, well-known in the geek world, mainly from his brief, somewhat terse, pithy reviews of Mac OS X, but also from just generally being an all-around great geek. That's how I would describe you. Good geek to know.
Sure.
That's your introduction.
All right.
But John, you were telling me early on when we were talking about this, that Goodfellas is a very special movie to you, and that you would not tolerate me talking about this movie with anybody else, not just before you, but ever.
Yeah, I want a dibs.
You want a dibs, and you want because, this to be the definitive.
You and Gruber did all the Bond movies,
right?
And I could see you sliding very easily into, it's like, oh, he didn't want to do Kubrick, so I could just see you sliding right into the gangster movie, so I had to jump in there and say, no, dibs.
Do you want dibs on all gangster films, or just this one?
I want this one and the two Godfathers.
Okay.
You can have Casino.
That's a good one. Not as good. It's not as good as this, but...
Yeah, I know.
So, part of the reason why we've been waiting so long to do this, and this is a whole lot of meta content to just get down to business, which we'll do in a second, but we waited a long time because we wanted to make sure we had the right time frame to do it. I have only seen the movie 50 or 60 times, and I haven't seen it within the last month, so I wanted to make sure I rewatched it. John says he claims he does not need to rewatch it, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about this thing. Now, if you haven't already watched Goodfellas, I would say, again, shame on you, but stop now. Don't listen to this. Go watch it and come back right here, right now. Okay, you've seen it. Now, everybody here has seen it, right? We hope.
Seriously, you should have seen this movie already, but I won't tell if you haven't.
But now, if they're still here, they've seen it. They don't just want to hear us talking about it. They've seen it.
I've got disclaimers, too. You want me to do brief disclaimer?
Let's hit them all.
Yeah. So my disclaimer is I'll speak for myself, and then Dan can say whether he thinks this applies to him as well. If you haven't listened to The Incomparable, which is a show that I'm on occasionally with a whole bunch of other geeks, we occasionally talk about movies. This is probably going to be a similar deal. And my disclaimer is that I haven't studied film. I haven't gone to film school. I've seen a lot of movies, but probably no more than your average person. I probably don't know the correct terms for all these movie things, and I'm probably going to cite a bunch of things in this movie that are going to make people who know about movies and the history of movies put their teeth on edge because they'll say things that are incorrect about the history of movies or use the wrong term. I'm just a fan. So that's where I'm coming from in this. So if you're expecting like deep commentary about the art of film and the history of cinema, this is not going to be it. And I don't know if Dan went to film school, so he can speak for himself there.
No. I was actually briefly a film major in college, but I took one class. So I anything that I might have learned is long gone. This is decades ago. So I will be sure to use all the wrong terms as well. But that's all right. That's not what this show is about. We're not film critics. We're just talking.
We're fans.
We're fans. We're fans of a movie, and we really want to talk about it.
Yep.
So let's do it.
Yep. I thought we would go through chronologically.
Yeah.
So that's usually the way to do it. If we go through chronologically and actually covered all of my notes, we would be here for 12 hours.
All right, so I've got the day open. Got it open.
Yeah, we're going to have to skim through some stuff. But I bolded a bunch of sections of my notes that were particularly important that I wanted to highlight. And when I went back and looked at it, it looks like I've put in bold almost the entire opening of the movie. I do want to really delve into the opening of the movie, even if it means we don't have time for the later parts.
No, that's fine. And that was what I was thinking as I was watching this thing again and taking notes and writing down quotes and things like that. It really does seem like the beginning of this movie, really the first, almost the first half of the movie, it is so great. And there's so much that happens that you could almost look at that independently. You could almost look at that as the first third of the movie, maybe as a whole separate thing unto itself. And I honestly believe, I'd still like to hear, we need to set up a little more background about you. Why is this movie so important to you?
Yeah, actually,
before we start in on the movie, right?
We keep doing more preface stuff. If you've listened to Hypercritical and you're expecting me to tell you everything that's wrong with this movie, this is not going to be the podcast for you. Because Goodfellas is one of my favorite movies of all time.
I think it's one of the best movies of all time.
Right. And so we are both big fans of this movie. And I think during the course of discussing it, it'll become more clear to me, clear to the listeners why this is such an important movie for
me. But you don't want to spoil it. I don't want to steal the thunder.
And I assume we're both fans of, you know, movies about organized crime and the mafia and stuff like that. And this is a...
Do you call him Marty?
Do I call Scorsese Marty?
Yeah.
We're not on a first name basis. Okay. Our eyebrows maybe, but the rest of us not.
Okay. So we open this movie. And there's so many scenes in this that really are quintessential modern cinema in so many ways. This movie opens up. They've got Henry.
You've gone too far already.
Already.
I said I cut these notes in the opening. I actually want to start with
the credits, zooming in.
Yeah, right. The credits. All right. So if you watch like an old movie, like a really old movie, like the credits go on forever in the opening. You ever try to put on like, you know, some kids movie or something, or like Snow White, or I don't know, which is Cinderella or something. And you're like, geez, is that, they have like 10 minutes of credits and the kids get antsy, right? In the old days, you used to put tons of credits up front. Nowadays, it's always like get right into the action, right? Now, I don't know this was 1990, right? So I don't know where this falls in the continuum. Obviously, it's like compared to its contemporaries, but there's not a lot of credits at the beginning of this movie, but there are credits. They're small credits. They're subtle, but it's not like modern movies where the instant the studio logo goes away, you see some kind of action, and then maybe there's credits over the action, right? So what is this one? This is a completely black screen, and you get that car whooshing sound.
Right.
And I don't know why that car whooshing sound makes me think about the area that this movie was shot and the people involved in it. And it was I grew up on Long Island in New York, and I'm Italian. But there are cars that whoosh by in places other than New York and New York City, right? Why should these sounds of cars whooshing by remind me of New York? And yet it does. And I don't know if it's because they're reverberating against overpasses. Like those cars are probably a recording of cars whooshing by in Ohio, for all I know. But right away, that sets the tone for me of this movie. Because when I think of New York City, I think that sound fits. But kind of like, you know, cars buzzing around the city area, going through tunnels and stuff like that. And it is very limited credits for just the top line people, right? And then you get this film is based on a true story. Which when you see that at the beginning of the movie, usually that's a bad sign, right?
Yeah, right. That's a warning. But in this case, it's not.
it's like Law and Order ripped from the headlines. All based on a true story. You came up with some story, you made some crappy adaptation of it, right? So it's kind of a nice start with the sound, but then you're like, oh, based on a true story. And then they show you an old American car on the highway, like a big 70s boat. I don't know what model it is. It's got a vinyl roof on it and everything. And then you get a title card, which is also a throwback. Like, what kind of movies have title cards?
Yeah.
And, you know, if they do nowadays, it's always over some crane shot or helicopter shot or something flying around. This is a black screen with a title card that says New York 1970. So we established where we are by the audio and by that. And now we're into where you were going to pick up, right. Which is all the guys in the car, right?
Right. So you've got what really are the three main guys that the movie, I mean, obviously the movie centers around Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, but the other two big players are Jimmy Conway, which is played by Robert De Niro, and Tommy, played by Joe Pesci. And really, these three guys are the core for at least the longest part of the movie. These are the three guys that the action and most of the things that happen really center on. And it's kind of interesting because the way that it starts out, really the focus is on Henry. And I don't want to get too far ahead of where we are, but Henry kind of becomes the person that one of the few people, I would say, in this movie that you can actually associate with. Because the people that he is eventually surrounded with by are so outside of the realm of what you would consider a regular human being in the things that they do and the way that they act, that you need somebody to ground you. So for at least the first part of the movie, that is Henry. But you can also tell that the movie is sort of divided. It starts out with the Henry section, and then there's kind of a Tommy section, and then there's kind of a Jimmy section. Did you notice that in watching this?
Yeah, definitely. And it's clear that Henry definitely is our proxy in the movie, right?
Yeah.
But the thing about this opening is New York 1970, you get the interior of the car and it shows all of our players. Now, when you're just first watching this movie the first time, you don't know these are going to be the four. Well, you can kind of guess because it's De Niro and he's a big name, right? But when this came out, was Ray Liotta a big star?
No, I'd never seen him before.
And Joe Pesci was the guy from the Lethal Weapon movies at this point, maybe. Or, you know, not, or My Cousin Vinny. I don't know what the timeline is there. But, like, so these are going to, as we know, having watched the movie, these are the four pillars of this movie character-wise. But you don't know that when the thing opens. And the best thing about the opening is it's just four guys
driving
in a car late at night. They're kind of sleepy. One of them's dozing off. Ray is driving.
Well, three guys, really.
Three guys, yeah. he's driving in the car, but he's kind of sleepy, too. And you know this. You have to know this is a gangster movie.
Yeah.
Right? But you're like, all right, so...
What did they just
gangsters?
Do? You figure they just did something, but...
But you don't know. They're like, just in the car, they're sleeping. It grabs your attention because you want to know, like, is that how a gangster movie opens? Guys driving in a car late at night and they look tired.
Right. What happened?
And then they go, like, did I hit something? It's like, or do they have a night out and they're both tired and they just ran over something? What is that? Is that a flat tire? Did I hit something? This is a good attention-grabbing thing. And the reason it grabs your attention is because you know it's a gangster movie. And you know... Like, what did they hit an animal? That's not how gangster movies start. You guys driving in a car and they get a flat tire. Maybe, you know.
What is that? Jimmy.
What's up?
So did I hit something?
What is that?
Is it flat?
Is that flat?
What? No.
What the fuck? You better pull over and see.
The next scene is them after they pull over and everything. And curse like 19 times in the first three lines of this movie, which looked like they were probably improvised. The next scene is the car parked on the side of the road, and the guys are walking around to the trunk. And now you're like, all right, it's a gangster movie. Because why do three guys get out of the car and walk around to the trunk in a gangster movie? Right? And you know, they open up the lid, and there's this guy in there who's covered with blood, and they thought he was dead, and they can't believe he's still alive, right? And Joe Pesci pulls out what looks like a kitchen knife, stabs them a bunch of times. Now, this is, I don't know if people will think of this movie as being gory. It's not gory, gory. Like, they want it to be uncomfortable in terms of the violence, but not like, oh, look, his intestines are spraying out of the screen.
Right,
3D, right.
Right.
So what they have here is this squishy sound when he's stabbing him with a knife, which is much more disturbing than actual visual guts coming out. Whatever.
That's
squish,
right.
Squish, squish, right? And then he gets shot. Jimmy shoots him. And then Ray comes over. I keep calling him Ray.
Yeah, Henry, you gotta call him Henry. Henry.
Yeah, Henry comes over and closes the trunk. So up until that point, you're like, all right, this was an opening to a gangster movie. These guys are obviously gangsters. They had a guy in the trunk. They all knew he was there. They wanted him to be dead. They go back and kill him, right? And then he closes the... before he closes the trunk, you get a voiceover. And it says, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And he closes the trunk, and the closing of the trunk coincides, the bang of the closing of the trunk coincides with the, I don't know if it's exact beginning or the beat of the music they're about to play, and a fade to black and more credits.
Right.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
Here's another bad sign. Movies with voiceovers, also probably bad.
Yeah.
Based on a true story, and this movie has a voiceover, right? But the good sign here is that you got Tony Bennett singing Rags to Riches, which, again, this is speaking to people of a certain background. If you were Italian and about my age and grew up in the New York metro area with a bunch of other Italians and went over to their houses and the old aunts and uncles and grandparents played this kind of music.
Well, that was something that I wanted to ask you and kind of get a bead on is, this obviously there are some stereotypes going on here, but that doesn't also mean perhaps that it might not be accurate as well, too. And that's something that I wanted to know. Does this paint, obviously, maybe I don't want to, well, maybe you did. I don't want to make any assumptions. Was your family part of organized crime? We don't even need to answer that. Does this represent in any way an accurate portrait of the Italian-American Northeastern family?
Well, what the movie is doing, I think, is trying to see. I don't know how this movie works for people who aren't Italian and didn't grow up in New York. Obviously, I think it works well for them because everybody loves this movie, right? But for people who did grow up in it, these things are cues into your childhood. It's bringing you back to that time and place because it's not that long ago. 1970, I was born. I was going over to my relatives' houses and, you know, hearing this music in their house because this is the type of music that they like to listen to, right? And so they play that and bring versus like if we ever do a show about The Godfather, that music is very old world Italian. That's like my grandparents, generation or my grandparents' parents' generation. This is for the people viewing it who are adults at the time the movie came out. You could remember this exact music playing, right? And the opening of this movie, the first time I saw it, I was trying to to get a beat on what kind of movie is this going to be. This juxtaposition of saying, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster with the voiceover and what we just saw, which was, the thumping in the trunk, going around and stabbing and shooting the guy, was basically like, you may think being a gangster is like you saw in the Coppola movies, like in The Godfather, right? Kind of, old world and mythical and it's honor and killings and family and stuff like that. The reality of gangsterism is that sometimes you have to pull over and re-stab the guy in the trunk because he's not totally dead. And it's messy and disgusting and horrible. And this is juxtaposed with the guy, with Henry Hill. The look on his face, he doesn't look like he's having a great day. He doesn't look like he's, boy, I love being a gangster. The expression on his face is like, oh, this is grim,
this is
horrible,
the worst,
this sucks. And then he says, I always wanted to be a gangster. Now, if you listen to his voice in the voiceover, he's not like, boy, I love to get up in the morning, like from Jerry Maguire. Right? He's not enthusiastic about the voiceover is what we will eventually know from the perspective from which the voiceover is coming. But it's not a rah-rah gangsters are awesome or the honor of the family is so important. It's like world weary.
Yeah.
And so we know this is the guy who's going to be telling us about being a gangster, but this movie is not going to be a movie about how awesome it is to be a gangster.
Right. He's looking back on something and he's almost, after viewing the very final, and again, everybody's seen this movie at this point, so it's not like there's spoilers are possible, but in the very last scene of the movie where he's, in the witness protection program and he's picking up the newspaper off of his front yard and he, the last thing he says, talks about in the movie, how you can't even get decent food, that same sort of tone and cynicism of I'm just a regular, he doesn't say schmuck, but that's what he's basically saying. I'm just a regular guy. I'm a nobody. That sort of tone is, if you listen for it, that's what he says in the beginning. You almost can hear that in it when he says, I always wanted to be a gangster. Like, what did I, what a moron in a way. But shortly after that, it does take the tone of excitement. He did love it.
There's three things going on in that scene. That you've got the messy, disgusting nature of having to go and re-stab the guy in the trunk, which is something you never see in like a proper gangster movie. When you kill him, they stay dead. But in real life, sometimes you don't do the job. You got to go back. You got to kill him. It's messy. Right. And you get the look in his face, which is like, oh, God, this is all right. Then you got always wanted to be a gangster. And then you've got this music, which is all about rags to riches and ain't this great. Right.
Yeah.
And the voiceover. And the other thing I want to say about the voiceover is that the reason voiceovers are often so terrible in movies is because there's that, the old rule of fiction, which is show, don't tell.
Yeah.
Don't tell. And if you're writing a book, don't write that, Sam had a fiery temper. Show that he had a fiery temper by having him get mad. Don't tell people about the characters or about the story, show them whatever it is you were going to tell them. Because when you tell them, it's like, you know, I'd rather see it, especially in a movie. You want to show it. It's a visual medium. Show me what the thing is, right? And a voiceover often leads to somebody telling you something that you'd rather show. Well, here's a voiceover, but what they're showing you is like three different things at once. That music, that voiceover, that tone of voice, what it is that he says, and what actually just happened. And so, yeah, then we break into a whole section about Henry's childhood. So we've left these characters behind already. These adults, we're not going to see them again for a while in this movie. You know, you get the credits and the song goes through and everything. But the song doesn't stop. It kind of like continues on and the voiceover continues. And again, this is so hard to pull off. I can't emphasize how hard it is to pull off like the beginning section of the movie where you have your main character do a voiceover about their childhood. Like, that's just death. That's, you know, the worst cliche ever, and that you know, and yet we both agree that this is one of the best sections of this movie.
Right. Yeah, and it's so often when it's just like you're saying, when you hear that voiceover, that's like a key that, oh, this movie is going to rely on a voiceover to tell us not just the breaking the rule of show me, don't tell me, but now it's. But if you think about it, the voiceover itself adds a lot to the movie. But it could stand alone. It could do well without it. I think it adds a dimension, though, that's amazing. And again, jumping ahead to the end, by the end of the movie, you're so used to the voiceover that it's almost become a separate individual. It's a separate character, the voiceover, Henry's voiceover especially. But there are two other things that happen with the voiceover that I don't really I'm not saying they didn't do it. As a kid watching this movie, I remember it was surprising. And again, I'm getting way ahead of us here. But you also get the voiceover after Karen is introduced. Karen gets to do quite a bit of the voiceover.
I've got that in my notes, yeah.
And then at the end of the movie, when after he's been picked up and there's this huge indictment going on with the FBI and everything, and he's in court, He starts talking to the camera, breaks the fourth wall, gets up off of the witness stand and starts walking around the courtroom. Nobody notices that he's doing this, of course, but this is the point where it all breaks apart, and he sort of steps out of the movie in a way and says, this is what I've been telling you about, and now I'm just this guy. And yeah, I acknowledge that you're here and watching this now. Yeah. But it happens in such a natural way. But that's at the point where the narration switches from being a separate individual to fully caught up, and now Henry steps into that guise of the narrator. I just love that.
Yeah, and this whole movie, like, should you use a voiceover in your movie or whatever, the voiceover is just another awesome piece on top of this gigantic pie. This is Scorsese at the top of his game, as far as I'm concerned, because it's everything right in this movie. Like, experts only, like, beginners need not apply. You cannot, if you're a beginning filmmaker, you're like, I want to make a movie like Goodfellas. Like, it's, you know, that's an expert construction. He's got everything. He's got characters, the writing, the music, the voiceover. It's like firing on all possible cylinders.
Right.
And that's why when he gets up from that witness stand at the end and starts walking towards the camera, no one's jarred by that.
No. It's not,
like, he's got you. Scorsese's got you. He's got you practically by the first scene, but certainly by the beginning of the movie, you are caught up in this movie, and he just smoothly transitions you into that. No problem whatsoever.
Right.
That's a master at work. You don't do that on your first movie out, right?
Now, and one more thing I want to mention. You already mentioned it about the music and things. The music also has kind of two other roles. One of them is obviously to tell the audience that about the time period, about what's going on. Because if you look at the suits that these guys are wearing and what's going on and the things that they're doing, you wouldn't know that time has passed. You wouldn't necessarily know that, it's the 70s, now it's the 80s, now it's...
Yeah, look at the clothes and the hairstyles.
It doesn't change.
It
doesn't change. But the music, I mean, the cars change a little bit, but the music is what tells you, oh, now it's this time period. Oh, now it's this time period. And there's a couple things that throw you. Like, there's the scene where, and again, I keep doing that, I keep getting it. Ahead of this.
No patience.
No, it's not about patience, but this is really tied in. The scene where Jimmy is sitting in the bar, and I have a lot more to say about this scene, because this is a huge turning point in the movie. But where Jimmy's sitting in the bar, and Sunshine of Your Love is playing, Clapton song, people would say, oh, well, that song was popular in the 60s. I have a little trivia for you in the back of this. That song actually came back out and made it back into the top charts again at that time period. That's why you hear that song. But each of these songs tells you very clearly that the world, where the world is, because you can't tell from these guys what time period it is.
Yeah.
Which I love.
For the movie, yeah, because they are timeless, and they have all seen discussing the lack of fashion sense of the women in the mob later on.
Yeah.
So the beginning, this movie is also, in addition to being one of my favorite movies of all time, is the movie that I think demonstrates the most successful use of popular music in any movie ever. And it's not even like a contest in my mind. Everyone wants to do this, but it is so hard to do. And to give an example of how hard it is to do, think about the Watchmen movie, which tried to use popular music to evoke an era and do all the things that the reason you put popular music in your movie. It's not a horrible, I don't know. Watchmen has all sorts of problems, but if you want to see how hard it is to successfully use popular music in your movie, look at Watchmen and then look at this movie. He makes it look so easy. The soundtrack of this movie is basically a series of popular music songs. It's not like a symphonic score or anything like that. And this is a Scorsese thing. He's been doing it, you know, his whole career, right? But this is just a tour de force of like, watch this, guys. I can make a soundtrack entirely out of popular music and it will be awesome. And if you try to do this, you will fall flat on your face. And people do try to do it and they do fall flat on your face. So one of the things they do with the soundtrack is that early on in the movie, you've got the thing with the young Henry Hill, which, by the way, I looked up this guy's name because I didn't even know him. It's Christopher Cerrone. I don't know where he's been or what happened to him or whatever, but he's great in this movie. He looks like, you know, a young gangster kid, and they show him in his early life and everything, and they have the scene with him and his parents, and again, voiceover of the older Henry Hill,
right,
the whole time talking about the stuff, and then at one point they have, you know, he's talking about his dad and stuff, and they have the Irish guy who was his dad walking towards the camera going, "Did you have a good day at school today?" You know, and this is combining with the voiceover. Eventually you realize the voiceover has stopped and the music has stopped for the first time in the entire movie. There's no more music. And an Irish dad is walking towards the camera with the mother behind him. "Did you have a good day at school today?" "Oh, yeah, I had a good day." And they show the reverse angle, showing, like, from the father's perspective, moving in on Henry.
Right.
Right. And they do this too, which is also really difficult to do well. There's voiceover on top of the dialogue. There's Henry talking about his dad and the problems with his dad on top of the people in the scene talking. That's like trust an audience with, like, someone like, oh, you can't have voiceover at the same time as dialogue, because if the dialogue is important, what are people going to listen to? They can't listen to the voiceover and dialogue at the same time. You can. It works. If you are a master and you know how to do it. Like, I thought of this when I was looking at my notes, that this is going to be an audio podcast about a movie, but almost all of my notes are about audio things. The sound editing and the music and everything, the way it works together in this movie is amazing.
"Have a good day at school today."
"Yeah. My father was always pissed off.
Learned a lot.
He was pissed that he made such lousy money. He was pissed that my kid brother Michael was in a wheelchair. He was pissed that there were seven of us living in such a tiny house."
If you think it's easy to edit together music, people speaking, and a voiceover on top of pictures in a way that's coherent, it's not. If you've even just tried to edit a podcast with like three people speaking, even that's hard. This is just unbelievable, right? And they do it culminates in him getting a beating from his dad with the belt, and then they freeze frame.
Yeah.
They had freeze frames before, but they freeze frame it. And I remember when I watched this movie in 1990, I was a younger kid, and I'm like, when do you see a Hollywood movie that freeze frames? Like,
never.
Nowadays you think, oh, did my MPEG like freeze up, or did the stream,
right,
did the stream die?
But the voice keeps going, you know, and like, whoa, they meant to do that?
Yeah, and when I saw this movie, it's like there was no streaming MPEGs from the internet. So like it was just like, what the hell? You know, this is another example of Scorsese like showing like, I can do anything. With media. Do you understand what I can do? This media is my puppet to control. I can do, and some people might say this movie has a lot of showing off. There's a difference between showing off and being an actual master and showing I can do anything. He freeze frames it, has more of the voiceover going, that this is going to be a theme through this whole part of the thing, with the freeze frame with the mailman's head going into the pizza oven.
Right.
With that expression on his face. Oh, by the way, are we cursing on the show?
Curse all you want.
Into the fucking oven you go, head first. You know?
I know, and I love how they go after the mailman. They don't go to the dad. They know better. See, this just shows you, at that point, you realize these guys really are professionals about this, because you would think, oh, they're going to go beat up the dad. But no, they beat up the mailman because you got to follow the chain down. How did the dad find out? Well, he found out from a letter. How does a letter get to the house? The mailman delivers it. Well, they're not going to go to the school, and they're not going to go to the dad, because the dad would make problems for Henry. They go to the mailman. It's just, it's genius, you know?
And they get the voiceover like, that was it. No more letters from truant officers, no more letters from school, no more letters from nobody, right?
No more letters from truant officers, no more letters from school. In fact, no more letters from any.
You said, I'm watching a gangster movie, and this whole opening segment is full of comedy delivered by, in a world-weary voice, to someone who doesn't think they're delivering punchlines. They think they're just telling you the way it is. But it's funny to people who are living in the real world. This whole section is funny.
Right.
Right. Another thing in this opening section is they showed, this is one of the first scenes that involves food in this movie, which is another easy trigger for people who grew up Italian, where they show the people grilling in the backyard. And they're grilling on top of that, like, it's not chicken wire fence, but like, instead of having like a regular cross grill things, it's like diamond shape.
Right.
I don't know what you call that, but my grandfather had a grill like that. Those sausages were on the grill. And I don't know if they show them, and I should script through the movie and find it, but the coiled sausage, I had to look up the name of this, but in the New York area, you go into a good, a butcher, Italian butcher or something like that, you can get a coil of parsley and cheese sausage. Have you ever had that in your life?
Yeah.
I don't know if they have that in the rest of the country. I just assume that, you know.
I grew up in Philadelphia, so what you had, I had some of.
Do you know what that's called?
I don't know.
I didn't know either. I had to look it up. Apparently it says Luganega, Luganega. It's a kind of coiled sausage that's a really small sausage in a tight coil, kind of like it makes a circle out of it.
Right.
I don't even know if they show that exactly in this movie, but these little pieces, like what kind of grill someone might be using and what they might be cooking on it in their backyard in the summer, are just easy, easy hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, elbow triggers to people who grew up in this life.
Right.
And nobody does this life in terms of the set. You can talk more about this in Casino, because that's a different life that I don't know, but I've always heard that it was very accurate in terms of the costumes, the setting, what people wear when they're just hanging out in their backyard, what they're eating, the fact that food was something big. And the camera lingers on these details. Lingering on the food cooking is not a plot point in this movie. We are not seeing that backyard barbecue where we're being introduced to everybody. You know, we're not seeing that because food is going to be, you know, it's going to be poisoned later, right? Because later in the movie,
no foreshadowing associated. But the food is a theme. There's all the different get-togethers, the dinners, the things that happen at the different dinners, the way they eat in prison. At the very end of the movie, when Paulie is frying up the sausages in the pan. And now I'm going to have to turn my back on you. You know, the food, again, is almost its own, like there's a life to it. There's a character to the food. And it there's, you know, the first thing that happens when Henry comes out of prison, boom, we're going to, you know, let's go to Paulie's, let's eat. And then you got, boom, the big music and the big plate of food being brought out. I mean, it's as important as the music in some ways.
Yeah.
Showing the food.
The other thing I want to say about these guys sitting on the chairs in the backyard, some of them wearing the wife beater undershirts,
right.
Grilling stuff.
Right.
Sitting in the lawn chairs next to the chain link fence with the weeds growing, you know.
Right.
Hanging out. What these people look like, and this sounds, you know, that was just all Italian stereotypes and stuff like that. But this is what my relatives looked like when I was a kid. This is what they wore. This is what they did. When we went over, we went in the backyard and we had a grill, and I had a bunch of relatives who looked like this and wore these exact things. It's not a caricature, right? It's more like a loving homage of, of the way things actually were. And all the little details are obviously very important to Scorsese, getting the exact outfits and like what would they be doing and what would they look like, and they'd be sweaty and they're cooking these things and the one guy's poking at him on the grill and stuff, like, you know, and lingering on the food, as you said, because that will become important later as a theme, not because it's a plot point in the movie, but because it was important to these people's lives, and that's important. That's what they're trying to bring you into, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we have the whole voiceover explaining how the mob works. Now we're kind of transitioning with young Henry and getting into the life of being a young.
How he's like running with not Paulie, but the guy that helped him out, like the other big kind of chubby guy.
Oh, yes, I don't remember.
Okay, I love the scene that has Henry holding the umbrella.
Yeah, while he's calling
Tootie,
him on the phone.
Tootie, right?
I think it's Tootie.
So he's running, and Tootie's running across the street, and he's holding the umbrella over him while Tootie runs with a cigar in his mouth. It's just such a great scene. But this is where they say, oh, you know, Paulie hated phones and wouldn't have one in his house.
Paulie hated phones. He wouldn't have one in his house.
And, of course, it's the phone later on in the movie that is their undoing.
Yeah, that is a little bit of a foreshadowing. The other thing about this scene in the backyard where they're eating is during a lot of the voiceover, he's explaining the mechanics of the mobs and all that stuff like that. They have a shot of Paulie with a napkin sitting tucked into his shirt,
right,
chewing, and they slowly zoom in on it. And all it is him looking off into the middle distance with a napkin hanging down from his neck, chewing
right
during the whole voiceover. This is the shot that you, like, if you were storyboarding this movie, okay, all right, now during this section where we're talking about the mechanics of the mob, we're going to slowly zoom in on Paulie, and he's just going to be chewing his food. And that works so well to let you know, like, what kind of guy this is, what it actually means to have powers, that you can just sit there and chew your food. And that was like after some guy came and whispered something in his ear and went away. But right, the slow zoom in on that, you know?
For a guy who moved all day long, Paulie didn't talk to six people.
That's right. Yeah, and so you've got these, how exciting it is and stuff like that. Some more sound editing stuff. So they're showing how exciting it is where Henry is tasked to blow up some cars, but they're little Molotov cocktails, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he breaks the back window glass with like a tire iron or something. And then he throws the fire things in there. This is voiceover while this is going on. This is not, we don't care why he's doing this to the cars. He's just explaining how he's coming up in the mob. And this is after they just explained, you know, what Paulie is. He's like, you know, what the FBI could never understand. He was like the police for wise guys. Right. Right? And before they change the scene to show Henry banging out the back windows of the cars and throwing the stuff in it, you get the sound of the breaking glass. He does this a lot, and it works amazingly well, where the audio and the video don't overlap. The sounds from the previous or the next scene appear, you know, with the video of, you know, they're not matched with their video. So you hear the breaking glass, say, what the heck is that breaking glass? And then they switch scenes to show what he's doing with the breaking glass, right? And that switches from the slow pan onto Paulie's face into the more dynamic, like, dolly shot of, like, chase, you know, Henry's running from car to car, running from car to car, right? The voiceover, meanwhile, during this whole time, is still cynical, war-weary, not excited, but it's showing this kid very excited, like, this is awesome, I have to blow up cars, you know, he's going to stop running, run away from it. Then he runs away, and the big explosion blows up behind him, and you get another freeze frame with the kid running from the giant explosion.
With his arms out.
Yeah.
Like a bird.
Which is so different than the, you know, the big tough guy walking away from the explosion Hollywood cliche that right, we got today. This is like the kid running, kind of like a girl, away from the big explosion, and they freeze it on that. Now, they freeze the frame, but the audio of the rumble of the explosion keeps going. Stuff like this just drives me nuts. Like, I watch it, I'm like, how does he know that would work? You know, or if you didn't do it that way, it would be worse. Like, if you freeze framed it and you froze the audio at the same time, it wouldn't work as well. You know, the goes, right, but the frame is frozen. Just love it.
Yeah. And then don't they cut to the scene with the guy running down the street up to the little pizza joint?
You skipped over your favorite part, because I believe during that freeze frame.
Oh, well, yeah.
During that freeze frame of the explosion, he's talking about, you know, oh, doing this, that, the other thing, you know, it was great to be in the mob, blah, 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 blah. And then there's a pause. The explosion is gone. He goes, one day, some of the kids from the neighborhood carried my mother's groceries all the way home. You know why? It was out of respect.
One day, some of the kids from the neighborhood carried my mother's groceries all the way home. You know why? It was out of respect.
That's his, like, Henry Hill, the voiceover, finally being, you know, finally he's hit a part that has some meaning to him. And of course, the point of this whole section of the movie is to explain why is it that a kid would ever get into the mob? Why would you get mixed up in this world? And it's clear that, you know, it's exciting. It's a step up from where you were. And, you know, over the freeze frame of the cars blowing up, he's explaining how awesome it was that someone carried his mom's groceries home, out of respect for him. Right. Who is he? He's just a kid, right? He's parking Cadillacs, right? And then, you know, I think right after that, you cut to him showing up at his mom's door. How do I look, mom?
How do I look? You look like a gangster.
And, like, they pan up from his feet to, you know, from his toes to his head. And those outfits, like, you know, the wardrobe department does a good job. Again, Casino often gets most of the glory for having those Vegas mobster, because they have sort of more flamboyant outfits, but they do such a good job on that. And that, you look like a gangster. And then there's this really loud, swelling, old world Godfather-y music.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's, I guess you would still consider pop music from a different era. like operatic, right? Operatic, godfather-y type music swelling before the scene has changed from him dressed as the mobster. And you get, they shot me!
Right.
And
oh, then
it's the guy going down the street with blood all over him.
Yeah, because I love like, that.
That's what the world of the, you know, that's the world of the gangsters we expect. The guy with blood coming from and he's near a pizza shop and stuff like that. You know, but we're taken pretty much out of that pretty quickly because who is it? Tutty was his name, you said?
Tutty, I think so, yeah.
I'm so bad with character names. Like, how could you be a fan of this movie? You don't even know the name of the characters.
Yeah, Tutty's Cicero.
Yeah, you know, you wasted 8 fucking aprons on this guy.
Right.
So, like, not the, you know.
What a jerk. Yeah. That's what he calls him. We had to toughen this guy up.
Yeah.
And you know what? That's actually a great point because throughout a big part of this movie, that becomes a problem. You know, Henry is the least tough of all of them when it comes to killing, when
it's
it comes
not so
to
much
brutality.
The least tough is that the movie, I don't want to talk about Henry Hill, the person, who I think is very different from the character in the movie, and sure. I've never read the book, so I can't comment on that. But in the movie, it's clearly established that Henry Hill, the reason he's our proxy as the audience, is that it seems like he actually has a conscience.
Right.
Which is not necessarily true of almost everybody else in this movie. So in the very first scene, Jimmy shoots him, Tommy stabs him, Ray opens and closes the trunk.
Right.
And
right.
Henry Hill opens and closes the trunk.
Right.
All right. And this one, obviously he's a kid and he doesn't know, but his instinct is to help the guy who's bleeding.
Right.
And he gets scolded for it. So it's clear that he's, you know, he's not quite as good a fit for this corporation, let's say.
Right.
As you may think. But this is why he's the audience's proxy and we feel for him, especially the kid. How can you not feel for the kid, right? He's got the father that beats him and it's a tough life and he just wants to better himself and he clearly has a conscience, right? And so, and this is another example of show, not tell. And the other one is in the same scene when they show him with Tommy, the young Tommy, selling the cigarettes. And Henry gets pinched and Tommy runs away. That's a little glimpse of what Tommy might be like.
Right. Yeah. And I love it because when he starts running away, he's sort of like ducking away. And it's, I don't know why, but it's always reminded me, that scene always reminded me of the scene in Caddyshack where Bill Murray has just, sorry if I'm spoiling that movie. But spoiler alert, where he's just sort of blown up the golf course. Remember when he planted all the plastic explosive shaped like squirrels and other little varmints down
pretty
the holes?
Effect.
And he then it's blowing up and he sort of pulls his hat down and kind of backs away like, did anyone see that? That's almost like how it is that Tommy is just, he's just rolling out of there. He's just running away. And there Henry is saying, no, guys, it's okay. No, it's okay. And they grab the money from him. He doesn't worry about it. And that's the one thing. It's that kind of direction, that little thing that here's these two stiffs who are grabbing the money out of his hand. And he's not like, hey, give me that back. He's like, no, guys, it's all right. It's all right. It's all right. This is okay.
We need £1. Here you go.
Whoa, what do you think you're doing?
Oh, it's all right.
Why, will you get permission from your mother?
How many pounds you need?
What?
Where'd you get those cigarettes?
Get them out of here.
Right.
Get them out of here.
Yeah, and that's Henry's role, another role in the movies. He's always kind of like the peacemaker, the mediator.
Yeah, peacekeeper, right.
He does have the conscience. He doesn't want things. And the reason he's able to get so far into this world of criminals is because he's cool under pressure. You know, and Tommy runs. We don't even know that's not, like, we don't know who Tommy is. We don't know that's the same guy. Well, we kind of, you know, you could.
Yeah, well, you can tell. You can tell.
Later on, you know, but this is clearly establishing, you know, what kind of personality Tommy might have and whether he's exactly like Henry or not. And so he gets pinched. This is another one of my favorite scenes in the movie is that he gets pinched and they says, Henry Hill. And he says, here you are. And he walks up to the bench and they're just like, just go sit back down. And then the camera switches over. Henry's mob lawyer has the biggest shit-eating grin on his face.
Oh,
perhaps
yeah.
the maximum magnitude shit-eating grin possible in movies. And then you go back to the judge, who's like, oh, rolls his eyes.
Right, like, okay, get this business done.
And look at that. Look at that. The actor. I don't know who that actor is who plays the mob lawyer. But if you like, if you just did the headshot and you say, who is this person? You'd say mob lawyer. He just looks like a mob lawyer.
It's
the
amazing.
This is unbelievable. I don't even know what actor that is, but like just, and he's on camera for like 3 seconds total.
Right.
But he's a character in 3 seconds. That's good filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
And so then, you know, this is the kind of unrealistic part of the movie. All right, fine. I said I wouldn't criticize any part of it, but here, I can't help myself. When he gets pinched and the whole mob shows out for this, you know, this kid who works for the mob getting pinched. I mean, I guess they would be concerned whether he was going to rat, which is an important plot point. But like the whole mob is there saying, hey, you know, you pop your cherry. You know, that's, I don't think the whole mob would show up. But it really works in the movie, showing that he has been accepted into the family. He's passed the test of, you know, never rat on your friends, and you always keep your mouth shut. And you can see De Niro gives him a little smack, you know, hey, you listen to me, huh? You know, like, this is an important life lesson I'm teaching him. He's like, yeah, okay, and puts the money in his pocket, right?
Right.
I thought you'd be mad.
Man, I'm not mad, I'm proud of you. You took your first pinch like a man, and you learned the two greatest things in life.
What?
Look at me. Never rat on your friends, and always keep your mouth shut.
Love it. And so then they did the freeze frame with the big group hug around Henry. You know, welcome, Henry. You are part of the mob now. You've been with us. You've shown loyalty. You've done what we asked. You got pinched. You didn't say anything. And they do the another thing where the audio that's going to be playing over, the pop song that's going to be playing over the next scene starts playing before that. We get the Sometimes I Wonder thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then you switch to Idlewild Airport. Pre-JFK's assassination, that's what the JFK airport was. For people who aren't familiar with the New York area, that's what Idlewild Airport is. This is 1963. And then you get another tracking shot up from the shoes to the face of now adult Henry Hill. And this is another thing of like good filmmaking makes it clear that the guy you're seeing now is the kid you saw previously grown up. Because we just showed you young Henry Hill with that same shot of like from the shoes, you know, up when it was how do I look and everything. But here's an adult. The hair, the clothes, the car, everything. Like, you know, he's leaning against the car and everything. Now we're finally through. Like, this is what, that's what I consider the end of the first section of the movie. Of, like, setting up all the characters, setting up the world, setting up our proxy character who we care about with the voiceover and the music and everything. And you may think, like, okay, now the real movie's going to start, right? Now we're going to get into, you know, there's not going to be any more of this voiceover or pop music or anything. No, there will. You know, but it's clearly the beginning of this of the adult section of this movie. And that's opening section. A lot of people talk about, you know, the opening segment up with the, you know, no real dialogue and just, well, there was dialogue, I think, but like acting out the relationship between the two main characters and Up, or the main character and his wife, and Up, right, and meeting each other's childhood, how great that opening section is. This is another one of the great opening sections, and the degree of difficulty is much higher, because to show a sentimental journey of people who meet as kids, get married, and then one of them dies, not that I'm going to belittle that achievement, but the number of moving pieces and things that have to be set up and how they're done in Goodfellas is just, it's a tour de force of like, you know, don't try this at home, kids. Just, you know, just that opening section of that movie, you could just study for years to try to figure out how he does everything that he does so well and in such an entertaining manner.
What you doing?
Looking at my notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think at this point we get the meet the mobster section.
Yeah, this is an amazing scene, and the way that they do it is really interesting. And I think this is where it seems like it. I don't know. Again, this is where my knowledge of correct film terms to use is this a dolly shot? I don't know, but basically, this is where the camera moves through this nightclub, which isn't it called like the Bamboo Club or something like that? And it all of the different mobsters that are playing a part in Henry's life are introduced. Even some of them who are not in, but the one scene, you know, I got to go get the papers. And they're just sort of moving through, showing these different guys, each of whom you wouldn't mind seeing a little bit more of.
It's a Star Wars cantina scene.
That's right.
Goodfellas. That's what it is.
There you go.
Yeah. And it's not, I don't think it's a dolly shot, but I don't think the thing is on, I think it's a handheld.
It's a handheld shot, but it's a tracking shot is what I was thinking of.
And I don't know if it's Steadicam or whatever, but yeah.
Tracking shot.
So yeah, you meet this sort of rogues gallery of different mobsters with, what was the Get the Papers guy name? Johnny Two Times.
Johnny Two Times.
Yeah. You know, and the there's another thing. So you've got music. You've got the camera moving all over the place, showing you these people. You've got the voiceover saying, and there was blah, 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 and there was blah, blah. Interspersed with that, you have the people talking. So it's as if the people talking are aware that there's a voiceover around them and just wraps together into one big piece, you know, and they have them say, you know, ridiculous silly things like, hey, I took care of that thing for you.
Right.
You know,
I got to go see that. Yeah, I went to see him. You know, like stuff that's
right. It reminds you of like a mobster, right?
Yeah.
Just, you know, And this is all basically to set up the stage so that Jimmy can enter and show what a big deal he is amongst all of these people who are also characters. Right,
right. Right. And I'll tell you what a great entrance for Jimmy. I mean, he gets this entrance where you can tell this guy is, you know, he's big time. Henry talks about how he tips everybody. Everybody gets on, you know, the bartender gets $100 just for keeping the ice cold. And, you know, you get the impression that he's not quite flamboyant, but he's different from the other mobsters who all seem to be sort of more down low.
Yeah, and there's another camera over here. I have it in my notes. I'm trying to look it up in the thing. When Jimmy comes on, you get the fast zoom in on him.
Yeah.
Scorsese is not afraid to do things that they will tell you not to do. Like, don't move the camera too fast because it makes people sick or whatever. So they have all these tracking shots where they're following people around with presumably it's like a handheld steady cam or whatever, showing right. you all the people, introducing them with the voiceover, with the dialogue mixing them. When Jimmy comes, you get a fast zoom in on him.
Yeah.
And rising string music to accompany that, right? And then so the main thing people remember about this scene is that you get this is the funny how scene, leads into the funny how scene.
Right. The famous Joe Pesci monologue that has been parodied and repeated but it really is an amazing, amazing scene. And apparently a significant part of it was that was an ad-lib.
Really funny. What do you mean I'm funny? It's funny, you know. It's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk? What?
It's just, you know, you're just funny. It's funny, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Yeah, Tommy, no, you got it all wrong.
Oh, Anthony. He's a big boy. He knows what he said. What'd you say?
You're right.
Funny how? What?
You're funny.
You mean, I mean, I understand this, because maybe it's me, I'm a little fucked up, maybe. But I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you. I make you laugh, I'm here to fucking amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
No, just, you know how you tell a story, what?
No, I don't know, you said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the fuck am I funny? What the fuck is so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
Get the fuck out of here, Tommy.
You motherfucker. I almost had him. I almost had him.
Did you know that?
You can kind of tell that it was. You know, looking at the movie, I think we just messed up the sequence. The introduction of Jimmy with the fast zoom was actually before when Henry was a kid. But yeah, anyway, back to fast forwarding. Sorry, no.
Nobody smokes like De Niro. No. Yeah. Whenever they show him smoking a cigarette, I mean, nobody does it like he does.
He has significant menace in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Say.
Yeah. But yeah, so the funny house scene, a lot of this, I get the impression a lot of it is ad-lib, because a lot of this time I was downloading like the, you know, Goodfellas movie script you can find on the internet to try to get, make sure the lines are right. And you realize half the things you like about the movie are not in the script. Right. And I don't know if that's just because the script wasn't updated and it's not a shooting script. It was just like the script as written. But you can tell a lot of the stuff is ad-lib. The very first scene where like, what was that I just ran over? I think that was all ad-libbed.
Yeah. Well, what I have read about this is that apparently there was a basic script, but Scorsese, or Marty, as you call him, said, you know, guys, do what you want, ad lib as much as you want. And apparently, whether it was in rehearsals or alternate cuts or whatever, the things that they liked, they would essentially make into a script and turn into a script. So what I'm not sure about is, are those like first take ad libs, or was the scene ad libbed and then they turned that into a into the script itself? And of course then whatever we find online is not going to have those updates, but it doesn't matter because it's genius. It really nails the characters, it sets up. And I remember the first the first time I saw that scene, I mean, it must be weird to be seeing Goodfellas now, having especially if you're like an adult and you've seen that scene parodied so many times, that I never saw a parody. That was the first time I saw it when it was new. I saw it for the first time. And it's like, oh, it totally gets you. It totally gets you.
Again, they've I don't know if it's complete silence with no music at all, or they push the music down.
Yeah, way down.
Which gets your attention, because this movie is basically like a music video. And like the music is out front and the voiceover so far out front of almost everything that's going on. It's almost like the movie is happening incidentally behind the music video, right? So when they switch it, it gets your attention. And the reason this scene works is because it builds tension in almost a Hitchcockian kind of way. Not that there's something unseen off camera that you know about that the person in the thing doesn't know about, but just... That's why the scene, people get hooked on the scene, is because he manages to make the audience, full of guys who love gangster movies and big tough guys who like action movies, whatever, make them scared and nervous and tense. And he does it not with this big tough guy, not with De Niro being menacing or anything like that, with Joe Pesci, of all people.
Right.
Joe Pesci, this little pipsqueak, annoying guy with a squeaky voice. You're scared. You don't know. It's because it's like a socially awkward situation. And you know, like, you've seen this guy stab someone with a kitchen knife at the beginning of the movie. You know this guy is not just full of hot air, right?
Right.
And just incredible tension. And just the camera lingers. The people sit there. The silence stretches. And you're like...
Right. You know,
and the parodies are like, oh, you know, funny how, like, I'm a... They make it seem like the parodies, I seem like, almost missed the point. And the parodies, to me, seem like deflating the tension that we all feel in that actual scene.
Yeah.
Like, to get okay with it, we have to make fun of it to make it something silly, right? Because it's like, haha, you know, when you laugh about things, so you're not scared about them, right? That scene is unbelievably tense. And, you know, and they get the release at the end, you know, get the fuck out of here. This is Ray. This is Ray. Another example of Henry showing why he's so successful at making a life for himself in the mob.
Yeah.
Because he's the one who diffused that situation by calling his bluff.
Right.
And that's a lot of thinking about, like, what's really going on? He's constantly, you can see it in behind his eyes. He's constantly thinking, what's actually going on here? Like, is this, how should I play this? How can I save my own skin, do the right thing with these people, with these bunch of characters? And he's got to calculate. He's like, and eventually he figures out, it's like, okay, this is, you know, it's a bluff.
Right.
He's defused, but get the fuck out of here. And he goes, I almost had him, right? Who's to say, especially since we've seen the rest of the movie, had he not known enough to call his bluff at that time and in that way, how would that scene have ended?
Yeah.
Like, if Ray had not been socially competent enough and knowledgeable about the way these other mobs to work, that scene could have ended a very different way. And you get the impression through the rest of the movie that this is how Ray makes his way in the world.
Right. His job within the mob is to be that guy.
Yeah. And it's how he's surviving. Right.
Yeah.
But then, all right. So it's diffused. It's like, you know, I almost had him, and everyone laughs, and everyone at the table wants to laugh too.
Because yeah. They're relieved.
Sense for them. And then the guy, cause the poor waiter guy comes over, every talking about his tab and restaurant. You gotta look at this tab.
Yeah.
All right, and so you think it's like, oh, it's diffused or whatever. Then he gets the crap beaten at him, and you realize it's not diffused. Tommy still has this unreleased anger, and it's just simply been redirected to the poor schmuck who comes up to him and tries to tell him about his tab.
Yeah. You know? You gotta think about it. That guy did pick a bad time to do it.
He did, but it's like, it lets you know with Tommy's character, it lets you know, all right, so is he just a joker? Because we know he's violent and he stabs that guy in the back of the trunk. So you know he's capable of doing something, which is by his tension. But at this point, you still don't know the first time you're watching this movie, maybe he's just a joker. You know, I saw mobsters do mob hits. Maybe he had a beef with this guy and that's why I had to kill him. But is he really nuts that he would, you know, kill someone over a stupid disagreement because he got his dander up because he's insecure about, you know, that's his whole character.
He's super, super insecure, super worried about what other people are going to think of him.
Right. And so when he says, get out of here, you're like, oh, you don't know whether he's just a joker or not. But then when he beats the crap out of the guy, like, no, this guy has some problems. Yeah. And because it was diffused, and this guy is just going to come out someplace else. Right. And one of the lines I like in this thing, too, it reminds me of I assume it's got to be ad lib, too. It's kind of mumbled over because it goes into the next scene. But after Tommy beats the restaurant guy up, he turns to Henry and says, you're supposed to be doing this stuff, too, you know.
Right.
Which is like... probably because Joe Pesci read the script and knows the relationship with these people that Henry doesn't do this type of thing that much anyway, that he's got to point out that, hey, why am I the only one doing this stuff? Henry ever beating people up on camera? Why am I always the guy doing it? You're supposed to be doing this stuff too. Aren't we all the same thing? You know?
Yeah.
And then Henry goes, you are a funny guy. And then he pulls the gun. the final ending of the scene, you really are a funny guy. And he says, oh, that's it. And he pulls the gun, joking. But the point is, a gun came out. A loaded gun, presumably, came out, pointed into his friend's face, right? Right. That scene is very complicated, much more complicated than the parodies make you think. Because you're like, he's still joking, right? Like, they're all laughing at that point. But, you know, it's a fine line. And that scene jumps right to like the restaurant owner with the bandage on his head, sitting down at the table with Paulie. And who's at the table with Paulie?
Right.
Henry.
The peacemaker.
Right.
Let's fix this thing, you know?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite Paulie scenes. I love Paulie. Paulie's not in this movie a lot.
This scene is made simply based on Paulie's reaction. Half the time you see Paulie while the other people are talking, and every time he's looking at Henry off camera and with this expression like, what do you want from me? What am I going to do? This isn't even fair, you know? And then he says, reluctantly, all right, I'll help you. But it's that reaction. It's his facial expressions of on Paulie that are just perfect.
It seems like ad lib too. You're like, what do I know about it? First of all, he's talking with food in his mouth half the time. The way he phrases this makes me think it's this Paul Sorvino's phraseology or the way he was in it. All I know is how to do... I can't even read this. All I know is how to sit down and order the meal. Right. Most people say, all I know how to do is sit down and order the meal. He says, all I know is how to sit down and order the meal. The way he says it, like... Because I imagine that's his, he's not reading that line of dialogue, right? That's the way he would say something. It's just a strange way to phrase things and with his big lumpy face and his chewing on the food and everything. But yeah, he's like, Tommy's a bad seed. He's a bad kid. What am I supposed to do? Shoot him? And the Weasley resting guy's there, wouldn't be a bad idea.
You know, and he looks at him.
Tommy's a bad kid. He's a bad seed. What am I supposed to do? Shoot him?
That wouldn't be a bad idea.
I'm sorry I said that. I didn't mean to say that. I just mean that he's scaring me, you know.
Yeah, he gives him that look. He gives him that stern look. And this is reinforcing. So we got told, like, oh, isn't the voiceover supposed to be show, don't tell? You know, the voiceover told us that Paulie's like a cop for the wise guys. Here we are showing Paulie being a cop for the wise guys. That stern look from Paulie is him expressing the fact that, look, no one, you know, that's not, I am the police for the wise guys. You don't kill one of these guys. It's just, you shouldn't even say that. That's not even... discuss that topic because the point is I'm their protection, right? All right, so now we
get Maury.
Oh yeah, I actually left that out entirely. I cut him out entirely. Maury's wigs don't fall off.
Yeah, you kind of wonder the first reason you this is the famous pay me scene. You know, where apparently he's borrowed money and De Niro's in there. And at first you just think of this as a scene that maybe it's there just to show kind of what these guys' day jobs are like. Like they got to go collect some money from a guy, you know, and the way that De Niro eventually gets fed up and just goes and starts strangling him or strangulating, as you say, with the, you know, with the phone cable. And meanwhile, this is when Karen has called Henry about whatever happened I'm jumping ahead. That's a different scene, right? Isn't that the different scene with Maury?
I know the scene you're talking about, but you may have skipped.
I think I skipped.
Because you were right. This is just
the introduction to him.
This is a voiceover describing Paulie as a partner in your business with the fuck you pay me thing that Mike Montero has co-opted for his own nefarious purposes. Yeah, this scene.
I'm jumping ahead to the Karen part.
You get the intro to Karen.
That's right.
Where Tommy wants to go on a double date because he wants to nail this broad, as he says.
Yeah,
and he needs someone to double date. And so Henry comes along. He's bored out of his mind. And this, as you pointed out, and this is right in my notes in bold. Up to this point in the movie, it's been Henry narrating. They switch to Karen narrating.
Right.
I don't know if people really even notice that because he just got you by this point. You're just going with it.
Right.
He switches to that voiceover, but it's a definite change in perspective. And she's talking about how disinterested Henry was and he was like blowing her off. And her voiceover is intercut with video showing this going on and everything. And one of my favorite, first of all, I love her voice. What's her name? Lorraine Bracco?
Yeah.
I love her voice. I love everything about her in this movie and her accent. I don't know if she's putting on an accent or just deepening her own accent, but whatever it is, she pulls it off. And he says, And here he was pushing me into the car, pulling me out. And over this voiceover, her doing that, they show that's like a cut, pushing me into the car,
right,
pulling me out of the car. Like it's
perfect.
There's lots of visual, it's not a visual joke making, but like visual humor in situations that are not inherently humorous. Kind of like when you know, in a movie that's supposed to be about mobsters and killing and everything, there is an absurdity to the way these people live. And in the same way, you can hear someone tell a funny story. It's really not about anything. I guess that Seinfeld is a good example. It's really not about anything exciting, but can be made humorous by the way it's told. And this is compounded by the way it's cut together video-wise. Yeah, that this relationship where they do this this courtship between them, this kind of strange courtship, accidental courtship, where Henry's not interested until she comes looking for him and she's pissed and now he's interested because she's kind of feisty and everything
That. She's intrigued him at this point.
Yeah, and it's a good job with a good courtship. Romantic comedy movies should take note from this because they are lean so heavily on their stupid formulas that, Henry is a complicated character and Karen is a complicated character. Neither one of them is a cookie-cutter role from any romantic comedy type thing you might see. And I don't think, and Karen's not a cookie-cutter mob wife either. I mean, she's not. She's, she's got the Jewish mother and everything.
Well, it's funny. You missed a great line is during this sequence when they're then supposed to go out again and Henry stands them up and Karen is sitting there at the table with Tommy and the girl that he's with, and he's got food in his mouth and he's talking, I feel terrible, I don't know where he is, and that's when he has to drive to take her there, and that's when she has, but you're right, I mean, it's, she's Jewish and he's I guess half Irish and half Italian, and he's not even thinking of her as somebody he wants to even date, let alone eventually marry. And somehow seeing this different aspect of her personality, then he becomes interested, like you said.
Yeah, when she comes looking for him on the street, comes out pushing him, and that turns into flirting. Actually, I missed this scene when we were talking about how Tommy's trying to pitch Henry, you got to come on this double date with me, that scene where it's like, what is it, what do you want, no, I'm not going on a date with you, you don't want to be, why he's there, he's just like not the third wheel, but like he's not getting
he's a chaperone,
right? And Tommy's like, what, I'm asking you as my friend, it's a favor, and there's this conversation in the car, they're both sitting in the car at night,
right, as the restaurant's right. Burning down, and
this is a work day for them, it's them talking at work. What do they do at work? Because this is just after the voiceover explaining how you bust out a business where you take all the money from
you, bust the joint out, you light a match,
you collect the insurance money. In this context of this scene with like the building's going to be burning, that's when they're sitting in the car having this dialogue scene about, you got to come on a double date with me, it humanizes the work of organized crime. It's like it's just a work night, and that, what are you going to do? You're hanging out with your partner, on a work night or whatever. You start saying, you got to come on this date. Well, I don't want to come on a double date. No, you got to come. Do it a favor. I'm asking you a favor. All right. And, we better go. The building's burning.
It's great.
Yeah, they had the good scene with when she's bringing Henry home to meet her parents. Says, my daughter tells me you're half Jewish. I can't tell if that's supposed to be an in-joke for, the half Jewish thing of like, she's trying to give a dig. My understanding is there's no such thing as half Jewish. You can,
you could be half Jewish. Sure.
Well, if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. And if your mother's not Jewish, you're not really Jewish. That's
right. But you could still be considered half. I mean, you're still half.
Like she says it hopefully as if like, maybe you're not completely irredeemable.
Right. So right. Maybe there's some
cross before he opens the door.
Yeah. If my mother sees that. Yeah. And one thing I will tell you is, just as you've commented on the accuracy of the Italian family scenes and things, I will tell you, and I'll talk more about this in the subsequent scene. They nail it with the Jewish family too. Totally.
I feel like
perfect.
I can comment on that as well, because I always consider myself an honorary Jew.
Really? Has that been bestowed upon you?
I've bestowed it upon myself. I feel like if you grew up on Long Island, I don't know if I've ever said this in any of the shows we've done together, but when I was a kid growing up, I was in grade school and everything. My assumption was that the world of religion was basically half the world was Catholic and half the world was Jewish, and it was 50-50. And I was very shocked to learn that at coming of age and actually learning about this in social studies class, that 50% of the world is not Catholic and far less than 50% of the world is Jewish. But as far as I'm concerned, my upbringing, half my friends were Jewish and half my friends were Catholic.
Same for me.
And that seemed like the natural split of the world. So yes, right. I can also attest to the Jewish stereotypes in this movie. Yeah. Those stereotypes come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And they do a great job with it. And there's a lot of overlap there between the Italian and Jewish relatives.
Yeah.
I would guess maybe some of the actors that they have playing mobsters in this movie might actually just be Jewish and not Italian.
Possible. So it's what's good. Also funny is that at that same scene that we before he says, "Oh, I feel terrible. I don't know where he is." When Henry's waiting, trying to get out of there, he's rushing to get out. He wants the check, everything else. One of the great lines, again, speaking to Tommy's character and what he's constantly thinking about. He's like, "Hey, you know, wait a few minutes so we can all leave together, not like a bunch of hobos staggering out one at a time." You know, he's very concerned. He's always concerned. What will people think? What will people see? You know, and even in those types of social situations, even when it's just his friend and a girl, you know, he's very concerned at all times. And you get the sense that this is building up inside of him.
Yeah, I think the next one after this courtship scene is you have the also very famous, there's so many famous scenes in this movie, and with good reason, Copacabana scene.
Yeah, the Copacabana scene, and this is where Henry essentially is walking through the back door of the restaurant with Karen, and you also very much, this is where he is taking Karen into his world.
Thank you, sir.
All right, see you later. Thanks.
What are you doing? You're leaving your car?
Watch, it's a car for me. It's easier than leaving it out of the garage and waiting. It's a lot quicker that way. You know what I mean?
And it is a very famous scene, which again has that awesome tracking shot that follows Henry, if that's what it's even called, follows Henry and Karen sort of talking to each other and going through the back entrance past the long, long, long line of people. And, "Oh, I like to go in this way, you know." And this is how he goes in. Everybody knows him. He's tipping people as he goes in. And the best part of this is that as soon as the manager or, you know, the guy that's up front sees him, knows him by name, greets him by name, motions and gestures, two guys come running out with a table. They have a table for him. It's not like they find him a good table. They create a table for him. And the two guys run out. They slap the table down right in front. Put the little light on it with the little, you know, cable. Adjust the cable on the table. Sit him down. The guys at the other table send over a bottle of champagne. It just really shows what an amazing world the, you know, Henry and those guys in general actually live in.
Yeah. So the reason most people like these type of shots, these long, long single take or seemingly single take, you never know if they're cheating it in some places.
I think it was a single take though, in this case.
Yeah. Well, so the reason they're impressive to people who are into filmmaking, even people who are not, is you realize, boy, how hard is it to coordinate the world of the on-camera world? Is basically everything that's off-camera doesn't exist. Anything that's on-camera does. But you need to make everything that's on-camera look like someone outside a busy restaurant going through the back door, walking through the kitchen, coming in and getting a seat at the table in the Copacabana. And there's a huge number of things going on there. And people are impressed by these shots. They're like, boy, it must have been hard to get all those people to go. Because one waiter like accidentally trips or blocks the camera with his head or does or whatever. You know, for the frame, it's hard not to frame just like a static shot. And that, you know, frame a long, I don't know how long this thing is, 5 minutes long or 3 minutes long, shot like this with all these people involved is technically impressive. But there's been a lot of instances in movies where I've seen them do single take long tracking shots or whatever these are called with the Steadicam, where sometimes I feel like, as I said, people sometimes feel this movie, that it was showing off. Like, hey, look what I can do. I can coordinate this entire set of people to make an amazingly long shot without any cuts or without any apparent cuts. What a great filmmaker I am, right? And sometimes, like, I'm impressed by it too, and I enjoy it. But then I think, but why was this? Why was this here in the movie? Why isn't the whole movie one big long shot if you just want to show off? Or what is the point of doing this like this? And this is the best example of most appropriate use of a single take long cracking shot. And so the pop song, as always, you have over this thing is the "And Then He Kissed Me." I don't know the title of the song. It was one of those older songs. So obviously it's a song. This scene is from Karen's perspective, coming off the scene where she introduced Henry to her parents. It's during their courtship, she doesn't know what
what even does for a living. She doesn't know anything about him, really.
Right. And so she's this scene is showing Karen being swept off her feet. And so it's one long, big, dizzy tracking shot because she is completely overwhelmed by this.
She is dizzy by this.
Can you imagine? You were taken through this thing and it's just like your head is spinning. And that's the feeling that the camera work induces is the feeling that the character is having. It's not like, oh, and we just decided this is a tracking shot because we felt like it for the hell of it. It's part of the scene. It's part of the characterization. And that's why it works so well. And you have... It's sort of like the similar one where you're being introduced to everybody because then our heads are spinning. Like, look at this crazy world of, you know, it's like the cantina scene, but with the better camera work. This is this crazy world of monsters and all these guys. Well, in this one, you come in through, you got the big guy eating the sandwich. You got the couple flirting. You got the waiter writing on a piece of paper pressed up against the wall. You got the kitchen staff arguing with each other. All these little vignettes that you're seeing as you go by. And as you said, the table comes out of nowhere. The guy complains, hey, well, how come we can't get a seat? Like, this is... going on, like, all this dialogue and other little things that are happening that are not part of the main scene, all just integrated, slotting right in, right? And you mentioned that getting champagne from the table, Henry, this is for Mr. Tony over there.
Right.
This move, this camera move, is obviously it's all a big one thing. This one camera move to pan over briefly and show Mr. Tony over there and the guys at the table who raise their glasses and say, hey.
Right, and then it goes back over.
And then changes back. That little switch over, that's just like, you know, he's got it. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard to do those moves without making it just look like a big jumble of stuff. It's the little move over and the little move back to say, those guys, hey, how you doing? Because that's what she would do. She's like, she's dizzy. The table comes down. What am I doing? I'm sitting here. Some guys get a champagne. She turns her head. She looks over to them. She's back to looking back where she is, you know? It's an incredible scene, not because it's really hard to get a bunch of people to do a long tracking shot like that, but because it works as part of the scene.
And then they got Henny Youngman.
Yeah, Henny Youngman as himself.
As
which
himself.
Which is kind of difficult. I mean, obviously he wasn't that age in the time that the movie was supposed to be taking place at all. They got a lot of people playing themselves, and just like, look, I know he wasn't that old, but you put makeup on him over there, but it's like, look, it's Henny Youngman. If you can get Henny Youngman, you get Henny Youngman. Otherwise, you get some guy up there going, take my wife, please. And it's not Henny Youngman.
It's not him. It's not right.
Yeah, that's, and as you said, the Karen says, what do you do? Because that's the culmination of the scene. It's like, after she's just been through, it's like, what the hell is going, who is this guy?
I'm a union delegate.
Yeah, no, he says, what? Because he's stalling for time. This is Henry Hill. Like,
right. And she's like, you don't feel like you're in construction.
Yeah. He feels his hands, which is kind of flirting. He don't feel like, I'm a union delegate, which is basically what he thought of in the pause that he induced by asking what to make him repeat the question.
Right.
And that's comedy. It's like, I'm a union delegate. Yeah. As it was the Simpsons quote, when Homer became the head of his union, and they said, what does the job pay? Nothing. Aw. Unless you're crooked. Woo! Yeah. And you go, I take my wife everywhere, but she finds a way home, right? Then Henny Youngman's delivering his jokes.
Right.
The video switches to Tommy and Henry walking in the airport.
Right. They're now walking in, and they're about to do the Air France heist where they get the money.
And on top of this, you go, she said, where do you want to go for your anniversary? She said, someplace I've never been. I said, try the kitchen. This is going over. This is audio.
Right.
While they're walking through the airport. You know, Dr. Wessler, wonderful guy, gave someone 6 months to live. Couldn't pay his bill, gave him another 6 months. I love this crowd. This is over them going into the airport. And you're like, how does that even work? Why wouldn't you stop Henny Youngman is joke telling when you're out of the Copacabana scene? We're into a new scene. This is a pivotal part of the movie with this. It's because it's all, it brings you from one thing to the next because they're cutting from courtship to planning of a big heist. And that's how they bring it together. And then once that goes, what happens? The next song starts. You know, Henry talking about the heist, the next song starts in. This movie really is like a music video. I think what the next one is, the next thing I have my notes is Henry and the Neighbor.
Right, Henry and the Neighbor. So this is where he goes, this is the scene I was thinking of before where he and De Niro go in and they're with Maury in his salon. 212-555-HAIR. And this is where another great line where Maury says, what am I, a schmuck on wheels? And this is where Henry gets the call. During the...
He's at work.
Yeah, he's at work. And the phone cord is wrapped around Maury's neck. De Niro's strangling him. And he gets a call. Oh, yeah. Yes, Henry's here. He's here. And he hands him the phone, and it's Karen. And this is Karen calling him from a payphone booth somewhere. And this is another very pivotal scene, I think, the next scene in the movie. And Karen is telling Henry something happened to her. So he runs out of there, and he has to, you know, go make sure that she's okay and help her. And I don't know. You kind of hear Karen's description of what the neighbor, this is the neighbor that at one point during their early courtship, Henry had gone with Karen to their country club and met this tennis guy. This is the same guy that lives across the street from Karen. Do we know exactly what he did? Did he just come on too strong? Was there an implication that something more had happened? Do we really know? Is it important? I mean, whatever it was.
You know that she's legitimately upset.
Yes.
Because at this point, she is relatively an innocent.
Right. And she's not, she just wanted help and perhaps comforting. She's not expecting, because she doesn't really know, she's not expecting Henry's subsequent retaliation. She's not necessarily, I mean, maybe she wanted him to do something, but not what he actually did. So do we know what the guy actually did to her? We don't really know.
He got handy.
Just got a little too handy. Winds up pushing her out of the car. So Henry hears this, takes her back home, drops her off. She's now watching through the window of her house. It's the middle of the day. Henry, after calming her down, now walks over. He pulls out a gun. You don't know what he's going to do. Is he going to kill the guy? You imagine he's going to you know, if this happened to a regular guy and it just so happened he was a bit of a tough guy, maybe had a gun, he would walk over and you imagine he might threaten the other guy, point the gun at him. You know, if you ever touch her again, you're dead.
In a strange,
you know, testosterone laden guy kind of way, like that's what you expect him to do. But he beats this guy with the gun so badly. Meanwhile, this guy is standing there working on his Corvette with his two buddies over. Nice Corvette too. And he beats this guy so bad that the guy's like, and it's so gruesome to see this. And when Henry turns around and comes away from here, the expression on his face, the intensity on his face is unbelievable. Because yes, up until this point, I've got a comment about this. You have not seen Henry do anything like this. You have not seen Henry do anything. Yeah, he, you know, exploded a few cars and burned down a few buildings, you know, but typically, whenever they showed him committing their crimes or whatever they're doing, he's more or less like he's there, but he's along for the ride more than doing this. So now this is the first time you see him do something that you could describe as barbaric. And at this point, also, I think Scorsese realizes it's okay to do this now. Why? Because of Karen. Karen has now been established as a major character in the movie. She has now been integrated in as a trustworthy narrator. And at this point, she actually becomes the person that the audience begins to associate with more than Henry. So at this point, it almost, I wouldn't say it shifts away from Henry.
Yeah, this is Karen's section. You're right in the beginning.
Yeah, this is the Karen section where now the person that we can trust more and associate with more can be, if we need it to be, it can be now be Karen. And now we can see Henry doing things or going in a direction that before, if he was our only anchor, might have lost us in the picture. And now we're anchored in with Karen so that we can now see Henry do something really horrible.
I got a couple notes on this section here. The first is more audio, more sound editing fabulousness that I love. So he goes and picks Karen up. She's waiting at a phone booth or whatever. He goes out in the car, gets in the car. Karen, what happened? She starts telling him, and she's telling him, and her voice is rising. Then she says, and then he got really angry. And she's still talking.
Right.
But her talk is completely drowned out by the squeal of the tire. The squeal of that tire is Henry finally, for the first time in the movie, getting angry about something.
Right.
Like he's not the calm, cool one. And instead of showing him get all mad, the car is the expression of his anger. The tire is squealing.
Right.
And then, so, you know, by the time they pull into the driveway, she's finally calmed down. She's got her shades on. She's leaning back in the car. And he pulls into the driveway. They're across the street neighbors. He pulls into the driveway. And so they have their backs to them. Henry glances up to the rearview mirror and they do the shot that, yes, it's been overdone, but he throws it in there. He's like, I can do anything. Watch this. They do the thing where you're looking and in the rear view, at the rearview mirror itself, and then it refocuses so you can see what's in the rearview mirror, and it refocuses to show the douches over there fixing their Corvette.
Right.
Right? Them with the gun in the pants and everything. So the walk, as you noted, the walk of Henry going over to them, it's a walk. This I think actually is a dolly shot. It's a walk following him walking over there. And as you noted, he's like Han Solo.
Yeah.
There's no talk. There's not, let's have a discussion about this. Just immediately goes into the beat. Now, the guy he beats does still. He says, what do you want, Foco? You want something?
Right, right.
He doesn't respond to that. You know, I look at the shot. I think these are practical effects. They have to be practical effects, right?
Yeah.
The blood and everything.
Gotta be.
And it's, that's why these things are so, like, you're like, oh, is this a gory movie? It's not gory, and the violence isn't like Saw, like where guts are flying out or whatever, but it's brutal.
Yes.
Because of what the people do, and because of whatever squib they use to make the blood, like, he's not shooting him, he's beating him with the gun, and
yeah,
the blood just comes squirting out there, and it gets you, you know?
Because this seems like, I think it's safe to say that most people in their regular day-to-day experiences, most people don't see other people getting shot, so except in a movie. So we don't really think of that as something that could happen. And hopefully, most of us, it doesn't happen. But somehow the idea of like somebody getting pissed off and pistol whipping you or seeing that somehow seems like it's within the realm of possibility, maybe on the edge. But that's a kind of thing like you worry might happen. You know, you piss off the wrong guy, that could happen.
And this is also kind of a signature of Scorsese's monster movies in general, is that they're punctuated with these dramatic acts of violence, but in between, it's not like that.
Right.
So it's like these big spikes that come in. And
yeah.
So, and this is the character-defining moment for Karen as well, because rather than explaining with the voiceover what kind of person Karen was and how, you know, she was an innocent when I met her, but she came to accept the business or whatever, instead they show their courtship and they show the scene, he goes back, gives her the gun and says, hide this.
Right.
And then you get the Karen voiceover. And he says, can I do my Lorraine Bracco impression?
Please.
Again? I know there are women like my best friends who would have gotten out of there the minute their boyfriend gave them a gun to hide. But I didn't. I got to admit the truth. It turned me on.
There are women like my best friends who would have gotten out of there the minute their boyfriend gave them a gun to hide. But I didn't. I got to admit the truth. It turned me on.
I mean, that's all you need to know about their right. courtship. Really.
Why, and she why chucks anyone, the gun in like a little planter box in her backyard or garage or something.
And why would anyone be with this guy?
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, you're this is Karen's section and we're relating to her because she's entering into this world. Be like, but geez, why would anyone go out with a thug like this?
And then it cuts right to the wedding.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
the next
wedding.
Scene.
Mazel tov.
Right. Mazel tov. And then it shows a really just, and this is why I love the details in this movie. It right. And I'll tell you the time on this one in case you're following along. It's at 41 minutes, 36 seconds, I think. There's a shot of the two families who are observing this wedding going on. It's not like the extended family, which of Henry, which is there at their reception, but this is just during the actual ceremony itself. You see the two families and you see flashbulbs going off and things, and it shows you very briefly just sort of, you know, the little clapping from each family, and it shows you each family just for 1 second, and they both look really unhappy about the wedding.
But the Jewish family looks like they're deer in the headlights.
Yes.
It's like, especially the mother is like, oh, geez.
What is going on? And then you get another song and a new segment of Henry's life, Life is But a Dream. And you see Karen again from her perspective. And again, the whole head is spinning motif, very literally the camera spinning around Karen as she is there. And then receiving these gifts of money from all of this long, long, long line. And at first you see Polly walk up and hand her some money here, you know, help you get started. And then you quickly realize that there is a long line of people, and all the only gifts that these people would even think of bringing to a wedding. Is there a gift table? No, there is no gift table. There's a bag, and into the bag goes envelope after envelope after envelope of cash. That's what. And then later you have Karen dancing with Henry saying, where's the bag? Where's the bag? Where's the bag? Oh, you don't have to worry about that here, Karen. Don't worry about that here. The bag could be anywhere. Don't worry about it. It's great.
She got introduced to the whole family. Got to kiss everybody on the cheek, which, right. You know, it's normal in an Italian family. But if you're not from that world, it seems weird. She's introduced to everybody who's named Paulie or Marie. That's a little bit over the top with the stereotype, but there are a lot of common names. But the best thing about this shot, you know, this whole scene is, again, it's like a little music video where she's got the voiceover, her explaining, like, I couldn't believe this family and this money. You're panning through the wedding. As you're panning through, everybody at one of those wedding tables is having a discussion that you're, that, like, the uncles or whatever have at a wedding table discussion. Like, I don't know if that's all. It couldn't be scripted, but they all do it so well because the camera is just going across them. And they're, you know, obviously not aware of it, and the camera's going across them, like good actors. And they're having these little snippets of dialogue, you know, complaining about the food or talking about whatever, or saying it was, you know, they're all in character being their characters while this voiceover is happening. And it's not just the choice of the song they do with this, but the song, they, you know, it's lined up. So it all culminates in the big spinning and, you know, her head was spinning and the dancing. A lot of these songs, people might say, they're a little on the nose. Like the lyrics of the song basically spell out what the scene is about. But they're appropriate for the, you know, if wedding music it can't be on the nose, what can be? Wedding music is always on the nose. That's what wedding music is like. And this, the... how tasteful a wedding is. I don't know. Some people say like the Long Island weddings have a bad reputation for being gaudy and not tasteful. Long Island Italian weddings in particular. And unfortunately, Jersey Shore has exported a mutant strain of this to the world. But let me just tell you that Long Island weddings, the thing that the people they have dressed like this in this period, in this type of environment, this is a very classy Long Island wedding or whatever, but this type of thing actually exists. And people from there have an affection for it. You know, it's not the joke. It's not to us. It's not the Jersey Shore joke caricature of it or whatever. These are real people like this who had real wedding. I've been to weddings like this, not quite with that much money, I'm assuming, but it's a real thing, and it connects with people who are from that environment. And that's so rare because I hear so much now. I'm a Bostonian now. I live in the Boston area, and you hear so much from people who are native to this area, watching movies about the Boston area and being pissed off about them because the accents are bad, because it's inauthentic, because that's not the Boston they know, because it looks like what someone thinks Boston should be like, but was never really like. This movie is the reverse. This environment is familiar to me, and I look at it and it rings true. And I think that's true of a lot of people, which is why, you know, those Boston movies that everybody loves, but Boston people disdain. I don't think there's a big contingent of people, Italian or Jewish people from New York who watch Goodfellas and feel like it's inauthentic and they're insulted by how it portrays the time that they lived. Not necessarily the characters, obviously, because we're not all in organized crime. Like, that's, you know, but just the setting, it works.
No, completely. And just to further punctuate the exact point you're making is this next scene, which, a short time after the wedding, you assume that they haven't quite got set up yet. The Henry and Karen are living with Karen's parents, again, the Jewish family. And there's this scene of Karen just sitting there on the sofa in her house. And the mom, your father never stayed out all night without calling.
What kind of person doesn't call?
Right. What kind of person doesn't call?
And, with his friends.
Right. He's with his friends. Dad. And she says, will you leave him out of this? He's suffered enough already. The man hasn't been able to digest a decent meal in 6 weeks. That's every Jewish family.
Yeah, I had that bolded with that quote exactly pulled out. Because, yes, the man... who is beaten down by life. He doesn't even say a word.
It just sits there.
That's his survival. That's his survival adaptation.
Right. And the funny thing is that the mom is saying, your father never stayed out all night without calling. And and then the next line after she says, Dad, will you leave him out of this? So the mom brings him up and then, well, no, don't bring him in.
Yeah, so you got this.
Every Jewish family.
When Henry finally does come home, so Karen has been waiting up for him. She leaps up off the couch, but mom leaps up off the couch. They've both been waiting for him. She cuts her off at the door.
It's great. And he just starts, that it's this forced laughter that he just has to laugh. If he doesn't laugh, he's going to go nuts right there. So he's clearly been out all night. He's totally disheveled. He's, you know, it's barely morning. You know, the sun is just coming up and he turns around and who's in the car with him? But Tommy, what's wrong with you, Henry? It's great. Very, very nice little slice of life.
And this is character development for Karen, because we're gonna see when push comes to shove, what is her choice? Is it her new husband or her family? And basically, you know, Henry's just like, forget, I'm not putting up with this stuff. He's out of there, right? And she's got to make the choice. Do I stay in the house with my mother or do I go? And it's well, like, Mom, you're ruining, you know.
Right? You're so, screwing it up.
Yeah. So her choice is very clear.
Yeah.
Of what she's choosing in her previous life, her family life, her parentage, that whole thing, and this new life with Henry. The new life with Henry wins.
Right.
Yeah, they have her, this is still in Karen's section, they have her voiceover talking about the hostess party.
Mm.
And she's looking at all the other Italian women and just being like, they're not good dressers.
Right. They had bad skin.
They look rough. They look beat up.
Right.
A lot of pantsuits and double knits. I don't even know what that means because I don't know anything about fashion.
Yeah, I don't know either. Well, pantsuits, you know what that is.
Yeah.
So
what's a double knit? I don't know. If any women are listening to us and like, you don't know what a double knit is? Well, you're an idiot.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. So then the next scene, isn't the next scene the one where Henry is explaining, I guess at this point she really knows what he all does, and she's with them at that party saying, I couldn't live like that. And this is where he says, Karen, nobody goes to jail unless they want to.
Yeah.
You know, and what's his name? He wanted to go to jail to get away from her.
Yeah, and we don't know whether that's true because we know Henry knows exactly what to say to calm people down.
Exactly. Right? Pretty much you understand at this point that everything Henry is saying is to just smooth things over at all times to everybody.
And sometimes to himself. Like, yeah. He only goes to jail if they want to. He believes this himself probably too, like the overarching theme, whether the details of it are right, and he's lying to his wife. And so Karen, even though she wants to be in his life, she still needs to be reassured, you know.
Right. And then the next scene, you've got him going, quote unquote, going to work and her saying, wait, I want to go shopping. I need some money. Oh, how much do you need? Yeah. And they are now at the point where they're measuring money based on the size of the stack in thickness. Oh, this much. And she holds up her fingers. It's funny. You know how quickly she has now assimilated into this life. At first she's saying, I couldn't live like that. 5 minutes later, I need this much money.
And so this is clearly scripted, but the delivery is what sells it. When she's the FBI people come to the house.
Right.
And she's, you know, it's like just a routine thing. If you're married to a mobster, occasionally they come in, they harass you. It's no big deal or whatever. Yeah. And she's talking, her line is a funny line about how some of the other wives deal with the situation. But the delivery of it is key because, and in one particular aspect that rings true with me is that there's no pause between the last two sentences. It's all together. So it's just like, you know, some of the wives like Mickey Conway used to curse at them and spit on their floor. She used to spit on her own floor. That never made sense to me. So used to spit on her own floor is the end of a sentence. That never made sense to me is the second sentence. But when it's said by Lorraine Bracco in this movie, it's one big long sentence. And it's a funny line and it, you know, she sells it. But that kind of delivery, again, I don't know what Lorraine Bracco's real accent is or what she... or where she was brought up, or if she had a coach on these type of things. But
it's spot on growing up in the Northeast.
That manner of speaking,
it's spot on.
That's not on the page. You have to know like how people talk to do that type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, but she nails it. And that's the funny thing is like there's people that I know and here, again, like you were saying in the beginning, 50% of my friends were Catholic. The other 50% were Jewish. When you grow up in certain areas of the Northeast, I suspect, you hear this kind of talking that in all of the accents, all of the phrasing, everything that they say in, and the way the people sound in that movie and the whole thing, it has a certain sound to it that if you grew up in those places, maybe even especially in those time periods, that it sounds like home in a way. And the way that they do the phrasing and everything like that, it doesn't occur to me unless I put myself outside of it that this sounds different to other people. Like this, like it would be like if we were watching a movie, you know, that took place in, you know, Alabama and everybody had an Alabama accent and everybody was talking that way, like for Forrest Gump or whatever. And it, well, that sounds a certain way, but and maybe Forrest Gump is a bad example. But if there was a movie that took place in a place where there was a strong accent, a strong sort of way of speaking, people might hear it and say, "Oh yeah, I grew up there. That is the way people talk." But you don't realize it to me anyway, and probably to you, this just is the way people talked. But the ability of
had a third person who was an outsider.
I know.
Give us the perspective on how does this seem. I contend that this movie is better for people who know it than the people who don't. Not that it's not a great movie to everybody.
Technically, that's impossible for you to know.
Yes. All right. And so the next scene change, this is another turning point in the movie. We've basically gone through Karen's section here.
Yeah.
And so they start playing the next song. I wish I knew the titles of all these songs. I'm sorry, classic music fans who are sad that I don't. But it's I Always Dreamed a Boy Would Come Along, and he'd be tall and handsome, rich and strong, with the horns in between.
Right.
But now that boy I love has come to me, and he sure ain't the way I thought he'd be. Again, on the nose, right? Now, we just got through Karen's section. This music and the horn section and the way the slow pace goes knows you're in for something, and right. It's kind of foreshadowing what the next section is going to be about. The title card over this, it's not a title card, but the text over the screen says June 11th, 1970. So this will be, for the rest of the movie, we will continue to increase in granularity of these time shots, because when it was like New York in 1970, now it's June 11th, 1970.
Right.
Now days are important.
Because these events that are going to shape things. And also what it also tells us is that 1970, oh, hey, we're back pretty much where the movie started now.
Right. And if you think about it, you did all of Henry's life in like the first section, like 18 years.
Right.
And then several years, and then a courtship, and then a marriage. And now we're down to days. And this increase in granularity of like when movies do like the 5 years ago or 4 months later or whatever, it almost seems like arbitrary, whereas all the timeline, the chronology of this movie works to build to a climax by getting closer and closer and closer to real time, and as you pointed out, to wrap around to, oh, we're getting up to where the beginning of the movie was.
Right.
It's just masterful the way the movie builds towards.
It's amazing. Then you get it. Here's another scene that I think people would refer back to as being one of the definitive scenes of the movie, which is the shine box scene.
Is that what you call it?
What would you call it?
The Billy Bat scene. You can call it the shine box scene. But yeah, very similar to the "Am I a Clown? Do I Amuse You?" scene. Right. Can you believe neither one of us did our Joe Pesci impression during that scene?
I'm not going to do it because I don't want to do that impression. Plus, if things go well, people will have heard. People, if we have the time that I hope we have now, of course I'll have to edit this out if we don't. But I'm going to try and put in some dialogue and things like that. So hopefully people will have heard the
scene. So this is the Billy Bat scene.
Yeah,
Billy
you can do your impression here. I want to hear it.
I don't think I do that well. Hey,
my friend Jimmy. Oh, Henry, hi. It's his joint.
Nice to meet you.
This is Lisa. Hi. Hey, Frankie, how are you?
Hey, Tommy, all dressed up. All grown up and doing the town. Look at this.
Oh, shit.
Tommy.
I forgot you was having a party with this mom.
Oh, come here.
Christ, let me go say hello. Hey, Billy, how are you?
Tommy, you know me. I haven't seen you in six
Billy.
Fucking years.
How you doing, Billy?
Jesus Christ almighty. You look terrific. How you feel?
Watch this suit,
you little Christ. Frick. Yeah. Hey, I know you all my life.
All right, good.
You're getting too big on me
just
now.
Just don't go busting my balls, Billy, okay?
Hey, Tommy, if I was going to break your balls, I'd tell you to go home and get your shine box. Oh, this kid was great. They used to call him Spit Shine Tommy. I swear to God. Oh, he'd make your shoes look like fucking mirrors. Excuse my language. He was terrific. He was the best. And he made a lot of money, too. Salud, Tommy.
No more shines, Billy.
What?
I said no more shines. Maybe you didn't hear about it. You've been away a long time. They didn't go up there and tell you. I don't shine shoes anymore.
Relax, will you, for crying out? What's got into you? I'm breaking your balls a little bit, that's all. I'm only kidding with you.
Sometimes you don't sound like you're kidding. You know, there's a lot of people around.
I mean, I'm only kidding with you. We're having a party. I mean, I just came home. I haven't seen you in a long time, and I'm breaking your balls, and you're right away, you're getting fucking fresh. I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend you.
So you got Billy Batts, who's a made man, who we haven't seen before except in the trunk of the car, but it's questionable, especially at this point, whether people recognize that that's the guy we saw in the beginning of the movie in the trunk of the car. Now, it's not like they're trying to hide it. You look at the guy's face, he's pretty distinctive looking, right? But I know from watching a movie with my parents that lots of people do not correctly recognize, is this the same guy from before? I don't know if that's your experience with watching movies with people too, but people surprisingly don't always recognize, especially in this movie where it's kind of like, you know, well, if you're not a duck, all ducks look the same, right? Well, I imagine maybe if you're not Italian, all the Italians in this movie look the same rather than being distinct looking. But I think it's you're supposed to know.
I did recognize him.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to know this guy. It doesn't end well for this guy, right? And so now you realize you're catching up to the beginning of the movie, and they're going to explain it. And it's just Tommy again with his anger and his insecurity, and the guy busting his balls about the shine box.
Hey, no more shines, no more shines, Billy.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting because the first time that I saw this, and I mean I've seen this so many times, seeing it again this time, it really does come across that Tommy is, you know, I mean, Billy does insult, like De Niro says, he insulted him a little bit.
A little bit.
Tommy, though, does come across, I think Tommy could have avoided this whole thing. And this is what I realize is seeing it this time, if Tommy had not been Tommy, or if he had been in better mood or whatever, he could have gone over and just said, hey, man, how you going? And, you know, he takes a little bit of ball breaking, and then he's, all right, hey, let me buy you a round of drinks. And it would have been done. You know, it was the fact that, yeah, Billy was a jerk and did insult him a little bit. But if he had done that to Henry, Henry would have turned it into a joke. He would have made it funny. It would have blown him right over.
Yeah. And Henry, because Henry's ego is not what's driving him to act. And see, what you got with Tommy and Billy is two guys who are basically cut from the same cloth. Only one of them is much later in his career.
And a made guy, yeah.
Yeah.
Are there people who need to have what a made guy is explained in our audience, do you think?
I feel
the
like
difference, but the difference between
I don't know. I mean, the movie explains it, so we'll get to that in a little bit. So if you don't know what a made guy is, keep listening. But okay. You should have known from the movie because they explain it.
They do explain it. Do you need to be a made guy to be a good fella?
I was just talking with mute on because I don't know how to operate my machinery.
Okay. So we're still learning how to use computers.
Yes.
As am I, clearly.
I was saying while I was muted was that this scene between these two guys here, you think it's been diffused because they do that. Like they do the thing and, you know, they're kind of tense and they go, but all right, you know, it's just not, you know, everything's settled. It's tense. They're not really like buddy pal, but the two groups of people at this bar have separated. But then Billy says, you know what? You know, screw that. Now go and get you. You know, and that's why you call us the shine box scene. Because Then you get that, you get the breaking glass, you get the motherfucker.
I'm sorry, too. It's okay. No problem.
Okay, salute. Now go home and get your fucking shine box.
Motherfucking mutt! You fucking piece of shit!
Come on, let him go.
You motherfucker!
Keep him here!
Everything going on at the same.
Keep him here!
Yeah, that whole thing with keep him here, the reason keep him here works as an ominous, because you know what's going to happen. He's going to end up in a trunk. He's going to end up getting killed.
Yeah.
And so keep him here is like, I will be back later to kill him.
Right.
You know, and that scene with the three of them. Now, this is a complicated scene for Henry's character as well, because like he's with Jimmy. He's with those guys. Right.
This is his place.
He's got to be with them, but he's not on board for that. Like he knows this is stupid and pointless or whatever. Like, so, you know, Henry's separating Tommy, pushing him back or whatever, and to keep him here and stuff. Like he's trying to be the peacemaker, but Henry knows like I can't, there's no way I can get out of this. Like he's going to try to smooth it over and everything. But now Henry shifts modes into, I'm not just the peacemaker here. The peacemaking time is over. Now my role is to calm him down and keep him here, so that we can have the scene where Tommy comes back and the only people left in the bar are Jimmy, Henry, and Tommy comes in and they all three of them jump him. And he's got no choice, but that's his only play there is to participate in that thing. And so they're stomping on him. And this is another scene that's been parodied many times with the stomping and the kicking and the killing him and the beating him up. You know, Tommy was going to shoot him in the head with his gun, but his gun fell apart.
Right.
You know? And so, and Tommy is just feral at this point. Completely lost it. You know, but it's like, that's what, when you have friends in the mob and you have one other friend who's like a nut job, you got to back them up.
So here's a question that I have is, Tommy leaves and he's already said to Henry and Jimmy, you know, keep him here. So at that point, it still sort of seemed like Henry was, I don't know if shocked is the right word, because I don't think anything was shocking to him, but I think there was some degree of surprise that Tommy was killing him. What sort of surprised me, though, watching it again, was how willing Jimmy was to go along with this. Because
he's got a little mean streak in him, too, because he was stomping with the best of them.
Yeah, he had that whole foot spin thing going with the arm. He's like winding up his arm to get more velocity into the kick. I mean, what did Bats do to Jimmy for Jimmy to be so interested in?
I think that's just loyalty to his friends.
I see.
He's always thought Billy Bats was obnoxious and probably always been kind of a prick like that.
Right.
But this Jimmy is loyal to these three guys.
Sure.
As we find out later, these guys like the, you know, we'll get to those parts. But yeah, these are his friends, and so it's friend Lord. And what does Henry do during this thing? He closes and locks the door while they beat him up.
Right.
He tries to pull Tommy off. He doesn't do any stomping or punching that we can see. And he's kind of like, oh my God, geez, this is, and he knows this is bad. Not just because like, so what, you kill people, you know, plenty of people get pilled, right? This is a made guy. And Henry's doing the math in his head going, oh, this is bad.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, so this movie is not a comedy, but then you get
Tommy saying, I'm sorry, I didn't want to get blood on your floor.
I didn't want to get blood on your floor.
Yeah, yeah. It was, he's kind of coming down from showing his vulnerable side.
Right.
They stop off at his mom's house.
What's right is right.
And this is basically a completely played for comedy type scene.
Yeah.
The same type of thing where they're coming into the house.
It's at night. The lights are off, right?
They turn the lights on. They whip the camera around. There's the little Jewish grandmother.
Well, isn't she Scorsese's mom?
I don't know.
I think she is. and then she's sitting there. She's like, oh, I haven't seen him so long. You know, they're like, oh, go to sleep. No, I can't. I'm not with him home. Yeah. And so she makes this great meal. Everybody's sitting there and eating. And what I love is you can see on Tommy's shirt when he first walks in, he's got blood all over his shirt. And then in the next scene, he's got like the napkin tucked into his neck to cover the blood that's on his shirt. And I didn't realize that until this very recent time that I saw it, that he wasn't just putting the napkin on his shirt because he's a sloppy eater. He had it because there's the blood all over his shirt. It's a great detail, a great touch. And then I love it. I love it because the mom looks over at Henry. She's like, you don't eat much. You don't talk much. What's wrong? You know, and you're, yeah, Henry, what's wrong? And Henry's barely eating. Everybody else, they're like eating and eating, and he's like chucking a little tiny piece of food in his mouth. Clearly disturbed, and they're not disturbed.
And this is the Hitchcock thing where we all know
right.
that there's a body in the trunk outside and why
waking
they were there.
Up,
but the
yeah.
mother doesn't know, and it's clear that she doesn't understand what it is that her son does with full clarity.
No right? idea. And meanwhile, he's borrowing a knife.
Yeah, well, he's got to hack off the, what do you call it? The hoof.
The hoof. The hoof. You can't leave it there. It's a sin.
Yeah. And so this scene has the mother's painting. One dog goes one way, one dog goes
so
the
one
other
dog
way.
Goes east, one dog goes west. So what?
Yeah.
And then look at the expression on the guy's face. He's like, what do you want from me?
Yeah. And look, it's him. And
look, someone we know.
Joke about the fact that he looks like Billy Bats in front of the mother.
Yeah.
Which is uncomfortable. And they have the thing, you know, with the story about the Italian guy. You never say, what do I say? That my wife two times me? With that joke and everything?
Have you heard that one before?
No, I have not heard that one before. But
it sounds much better in Italian.
Yeah. So all these things that are here, the paintings and that joke and stuff, what's the point of those for the movie? Do they drive the plot forward? Are they just filler while we feel is tension or whatever? The reason they're there is because I believe that Scorsese, and if the scene was from the book, I have no idea or anything, have an affection for their own mothers and for this type of environment and for this. And it doesn't drive the plot forward. And, you know, it's vaguely illuminating for some of the characters how they react to the situation, but you know why have that joke? Why have the painting? Why it was like I don't know what you call it. It's a vignette. It's a slice of life.
It is. It's just showing that what's also interesting is clearly this mom, unlike Henry's mom, she is an Italian mom. Because, as you know, Tommy is fully Italian, and both Jimmy and Henry are half Italian and half Irish. So Tommy is the full-blood Italian, and this is his full-blood Italian mom, who is obviously very loving, very caring. Seems like she, if anything, maybe even spoiled him a little bit. And he's a mama's boy. And yet he is a monster.
Yeah.
And that to me is part of what I think was being shown in that scene, that there's this culture out there that the mom thinks she's raised this wonderful little boy. And you know, when she, before jumping ahead a little, when Tommy is going to get made, so he thinks, She tells him, you know, be careful, you look nice. You know, it's all of these loving motherly things. And here's this guy who is a monster. It shows a very interesting, you know, reality there behind the scenes. You don't eat much. You don't talk much.
Yeah. And we kind of get that, like, we get that vibe, as you motivated the thing, I didn't want to get blood on your floor. Like, that there is this sweet kid inside Tommy, but right. There's also this monster in there. When you see him in the home environment, like, you get both at once, because he is sweet to his mother, and he wouldn't want his mother to know about these things, but at the same time, he's got practical concerns about that he needs a knife. You know?
Right. Yeah. It's part of his job in a way.
And even Jimmy is a little uncomfortable, because he's like, oh, you know, he wants the mother to go to bed, but Tommy has no problem sitting down having a good meal. His appetite is not blunted by the fact that he just killed a made man and is sitting in the trunk in the car outside, right? He's eating and then they're going to go, you know? The next thing I have in my notes is the Saturday night was for the wives, but Friday night at the Copa was always for the girlfriends.
Right.
That's another aspect of the life that we hadn't yet seen, because we went through Karen's section where, you know, she was coming from an innocent and still kind of like, you know, but what about going to jail? Are you going to be okay? You know, the whole business. It's like, well, they're girlfriends. Of course they're girlfriends.
Right.
You know, it's just, they have a designated night for them. Right. And so they have another scene with Janice Rossi, where they're all at the Copa talking. Janice Rossi is, I think she was with Tommy at that point.
Yeah.
Or no, maybe she was with someone else. But anyway, Tommy calls her on that. Like, Janice Rossi is like, you know, talking about Sammy Davis Jr.
No, it wasn't Janice saying that. That Janice was there, but it was Tommy's girlfriend. Yeah.
I don't think we really see her.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And then Tommy's, it's almost the exact mirror of the one, Mike Clowney. What do you mean by that? You know?
Yeah.
And he's nicer to the girlfriend.
Let's say he's like, very, very talented. Leave it at that.
Yeah, just leave it at that. Just he's very talented. Right. But the audience, knowing the character now, like, you're on edge anytime he says anything, but like, oh my God, he's going to kill his girlfriend.
Right,
and then
right.
like you realize, no, this is just a regular exchange in Tommy's life. And you're freaked out about it because you know what lurks under the surface. And again, on the nose, the guy singing, pretend you don't see her, my heart.
Yeah.
Jerry Vale as himself.
Yep.
Playing this song. I'm running out of ways to explain why these on the nose songs work, but they do. And if I will be interested, everybody's going to ask for feedback. It's not going to be a follow up show, but like, if someone out there thinking these songs do not work for you because they're too on the nose, because I think this, everything in this movie works for everybody.
I think it works great. And a lot of these were songs that I might have heard, but they weren't like songs I knew, but they really, really nail it. Even if you don't know the songs, they still tell the story.
Yeah, and again, so far out front in the mix. This is not background music. This is foreground music with background dialogue.
Right.
They show, you know, Henry's car outside his mistress's house, and they do he pulls up at nighttime, then it fades to daytime. I'm assuming that I understand that a lot of nighttime shooting they do in the daytime, they just put a filter on it because it's a lot easier to shoot at daytime. You don't stub your toe as much.
Right, right, right.
And you can kind of tell when they do that, especially in bad action movies where like this entire scene was shot at night and they just got sunglasses over the, you know, they filtered it. Mm-hmm. It looks bad. But they do the fade to daytime. If it's time lapse, it doesn't show.
Right.
I'm assuming it's just some sort of photographic trickery.
Mm-hmm.
But man, even this, it's like a 2 second thing. It's like, all right, I want to show that he's been there for the whole night. You could just cut to daytime.
Right.
No, he fades to it. Why? Because, you know, because he's Martin Scorsese. Because
he
can do everything.
Yeah.
And I'll do it smooth with no time-lapse jumps and it will look awesome. Thank you. You know, that's why people say this movie's showing off, but I think it's great.
Well, they just sold the property to make condominiums. Yeah. Gotta move it right away. It's been 6 months. Gotta move it. We gotta move it right away.
Yeah. And now that, if there's any scene that I think could be cut from this movie, it's this sequence where they have to move the body.
Well, it's interesting because the way that it's lit, they've got this huge, it's sort of smoky, you know.
It's supposed to be the taillights.
Right, the taillights of the car, right. Illuminating everything in red because they're about to throw them in the body that's been in there for 6 months. As Tommy and De Niro, Jimmy are digging, like, oh, look, here's a leg, here's a wing, you know.
What do you like, the leg of the wing?
And it is a gruesome scene. And then, of course, it's Henry's car. You know, Henry, who had nothing to do with this killing other than observing it, really.
Yeah. Oh.
It's his car that the body is getting put into. And so
he's hosing it down
the next day. And it's little details, because there's a shot that shows him hosing it from across the street. It looks like an across the street kind of a shot. And the little details, like the car is backed in to the driveway so that you couldn't see if you were walking by what he was doing.
Yeah, he was hosing down blood and gore.
Right. It's just little details like that. And then we come to Spider.
Actually, you skipped one that I wanted to talk
about. What did you do?
He's in Janice Rossi, his mistress's apartment that he set up for her, because set up an apartment for the mistress and you got all this stuff. And she's showing all her girlfriends all the awesome things, because you would assume that she's coming from a life that is not this successful, and she is now the mistress of a mobster. And then one of the advantages of that is that you get a nice pad set up for you and look at all this stuff and got this, what is this? You know, everything. And her friend, is it Debbie Mazar? Is her name Sandy?
The brunette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this thing, you know, this is Henry's mistress and they're having the party and all the people are there and they're showing everybody around and showing us stuff. And Janice has her, you know, little group of girlfriends showing them all the cool things in her apartment. And they show them into the bedroom and they make the joke and everything like that. And Henry comes in and I think throws Janice on the bed or something. All right. So when they enter this room, this is storytelling through framing and camera and everything. So they enter this room from the side, is obviously a set indoors. They enter this room, the camera pans from one room to the next. They enter the room. Janice walks off camera to the bed after saying this is the bedroom where we spend all our time.
Right.
And two of her other friends walk in, and then Sandy, Debbie Mazar, walks towards the camera in front of the little like vanity and says, what is this, French? Her line of dialogue gets louder because it's closer to the camera. Mm-hmm. She becomes center frame and you're like, well, it's signaling to you that this is the important friend in this thing, because, what is this, French? And she smells this thing or whatever. And she goes back away from the camera. But why did she get to be that close to the camera at that time? Why did Janice go off the scene? Then we go back in on Janice and she's talking about all this stuff, you know, and she tells a story about how they were beating up her boss and everything. And they come back to the scene. Henry throws her on the bed and he's like attacking her. And, you know, he's full of lust and tickling her and flirting with her and stuff like that. She rolls off the bed. He looks up and his eyes turn.
And he immediately locks in on
to Sandy.
Sandy.
Right. And just looks at her and just walks towards her. And she walks backwards and bumps into the frame of the door when she's on her way out. That scene, which had no dialogue between these two people, it just completely established visually that these two are the,
that's the next one.
He's moved on to the next mistress. This is the mistress. He's cheating on his mistress with this person.
Right.
I just liked how that scene was done, because ostensibly the scene is about showing you Janice and her life and how he made this life for her. But really it's about Sandy.
Right. It's about Henry moving on to the next Gumar.
Yeah. So that's Spider.
Now we have Spider. Now this is funny because what Tommy orders, the drink that he asks Spider for, is
7 and 7?
No, Cutter and water or something. Something like that. And maybe the chat room will know this one. But it kind of sort of does sound like he says, "You're all right, Spider." Kind of.
I think that's your sympathy.
Right.
Making you hear that.
Well, anyway, Cutty Sark is in the chat room. They're now saying Cutty Sark is the liquor, but I think he asked him for a Cutty and water or something. Anyway, this is another famous scene where Joe Pesci loses it and shoots Spider in the foot.
What am I, a mirage?
What?
Where's my fucking drink? I asked you for a drink.
You wanted a drink.
I just asked you for a fucking drink.
No, I thought you said that you were all right, Spider.
No. What do you got me on a fucking pay no mind list, kid?
I thought I heard someone say something. Spider, I thought it was Henry.
No, you're a fucking mumbling, stuttering little fuck. You know that?
No, I thought you said I was all right, Spider.
No, you ain't all right, Spider. You got a lot of fucking problems.
No, I thought you said you were all right, Spider.
I am all right. You ain't all right, you little fucking prick.
I thought you've
been doing this all fucking night to me, you motherfucker.
You want a drink now? Okay, I'll bring it for
you. Yeah, give me a fucking drink. Move it, you little prick. You walk like fucking step and fetch a plane. Anybody else, you'll fucking run. Run for me, you prick. Dance the fucking drink back here. Hello, prick. Hey, what's that movie that Bogart made?
Which one?
The one where he played a cowboy. He only did one.
The Oklahoma Kid.
Shane?
Oklahoma Kid. Shane. Oklahoma Kid. That's me. I'm the Oklahoma Kid. You fucking Barney.
Oh,
Dave. Dave. Yahoo. You motherfucker.
Come on.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Now he's moving.
Now, we all know. I shouldn't say that. But Michael Imperioli plays Spider, and he later goes on to play Christopher in The Sopranos.
And this movie is like a training ground for Soprano stars, really,
very much. And later on in the movie, in the first season of Sopranos, Christopher shoots a shopkeep in the foot, and it was in fact a nod to this scene in this movie. But it's interesting because you get to see a different picture now. You get to see Spider as the young Henry type of character doing the same kinds of things that Henry was doing. But during Henry's time period, there was no Tommy to deal with. And yeah, it shows how the times really have changed. Whereas back in the old days, I'm sure there were mob hits and things like that, but things really have changed. The focus has changed, and things seem to have gotten kind of crazier in a lot of ways. And Spider at the same time is sort of, I mean, he is kind of doofy.
Michael Imperioli, who this was the first time I think I'd seen him in this movie. And then later on, when The Sopranos came on, which, by the way, Sopranos is probably my favorite television series of all time.
Not surprised.
Yeah, although I feel like I do have to rewatch it one more time to give it its proper ranking. But Michael Imperioli, Christopher in The Sopranos, you would think like, oh man, this poor guy, his entire career is going to be defined by being Spider, because even though it's a small role, it's an iconic role that people, you know, remember. And he was the underling, the helper guy kind of, and it's so different from his character on The Sopranos.
Yeah.
And it's a testament to it, the acting ability of Michael Imperioli, that you believe Christopher within like an episode of that show. You've forgotten Spider completely. And Christopher becomes a totally very different character. That's the mark of a good actor. If you can play someone, you know, different. I mean, I don't know. So how different is he? He's a mobster in both movies. He's obviously an Italian guy. He's not playing, you know what I mean? His name is Imperioli. But it is a big jump up from that. It's a kind of like it's like a training ground for Soprano. So you got Paulie Gualtieri from this movie too.
Right.
Tony Cicero appears in The Sopranos, and his role is much smaller. But yeah, it's an impressive turn of events. Yeah. So by the time
Frank Severo, am I saying his last name right? Carbone. Was he in Sopranos at all? He's my favorite character actor in this movie, though. Hey, how's the moon go over there? that's every line in the movie that he has. All right, you didn't get the call. All right.
Yeah. And he has one of the best untimely ends as well.
Oh, he does.
At a certain point in the movie, all your favorite characters become, who's your favorite corpse?
Right. So, yeah. This is... Now, doesn't the next scene... Yeah, I'm not sure if it's the next scene, but I remember the scene again where you get to see Karen's temper.
You're right. It is. So after that sequence, you got the spider sequence, which we didn't talk too much about. But by this point in the movie, we know, like,
you know what's going to happen to Spider.
It's like resignation. It used to be like dread and you were worried. And now it's like the tension is still there, but you're like, this will not end well for you, Spider.
Yeah.
You know it won't, right? And so then you switch the in between the two spider scenes is you've got the ready-made horse scene.
Right. This is where Karen is going, has found Janice Rossi's apartment, figured it all out. She's now there with her two kids, slamming on the little buzzers and the intercom and talking to Janice over the intercom. And again, we've talked about the cutting of the film and the pacing and things like that. Another just beautifully executed film, because on the one hand it shows her talking to Janice, then it shows her hitting all the different buttons, and then it shows her on the phone, like, fast cut to the superintendent. I just want to let you know you have a whore living in 2R Rossi, you know.
Answer me! I'm going to tell everyone who walks in this building that in 2R Rossi you are nothing but a whore.
Sister Superintendent.
Yes, I want you to know, sir, that you have a whore
It's yeah, such a, she's there with her kids too.
Yeah, her kids are there.
This is the ending of the idyllic family life
right.
section. Because once you have to bring your kids with you to yell at your husband's mistress, that's the end of
right.
any illusion you might have had that you were trying gone. To build in the beginning of this movie that you have, that you're going to have a great family life because your husband is a somebody who makes things happen.
Right.
And then you have that goes right into the great scene where you've got in focus the muzzle of a revolver,
yeah.
out of focus behind it, Karen holding the revolver.
Right. Sitting on top of Henry while he's asleep, obviously yeah, napping right. on the bed.
He's straddling him. And so they do the focus switch where focus switches from the front of the gun to Karen's face saying, Henry, wake up. And Henry Hill, true to form, is like, if anybody can get out of this situation with the screaming wife who just was screaming at your mistress, he's like, Karen, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And you know what Henry's
Karen,
personality
Karen, I love you. It's you I want. You're what I want.
And you know from the scene with the Corvette boyfriend, you know that this is not his natural reaction. Were he to be true to his emotions, he would. But he knows he's got to, I have to get out of this without getting shot in the face.
Right.
And then right to the ground, he has no compunction about hitting women, no compunction about hitting her. And he's like, I spent all day working, I got to come home to this.
Right.
It's a much more extreme incarnation of like, boy, you're frustrated when you come home from a long day.
right.
You got family problems. Well, this is, when your wife is sitting on top of you with a gun in your face, right?
How does it feel, Karen?
Yeah. And he's not a particularly nice guy. And
no.
he has a bad side and everything, but his political side is what allows him to get out of that situation. And eventually, he's the dominant force in this relationship because she eventually goes, I'm sorry.
Right.
This is the life that she's chosen for herself.
John, we're not animale. We're not animale.
We're not what?
Animale.
Oh, animals.
Yes. Well, that's what Polly says. Yeah. You remember that scene? You got to go back to her. Go down to Florida, then you come back to Karen. I know how to talk to her, especially to her.
Yeah, yes, yes.
We're not animale. Would you guys do that in your family? Drop the Italian word in sometimes to really emphasize the point.
I thought that's one of, skipping to The Sopranos for a second, that's one of the great things about The Sopranos is it shows how mutated the Italian words become when they come over into America and are spoken by Italian Americans who may or may not speak any Italian.
Right.
And if you were to try to get a native Italian to say, what word do you think they're trying to say here? They would have no idea because it's so far mutated into this thing that is a conversation piece between Italian Americans, mostly with the food words in it.
Gabagool.
Yeah.
So,
Spider's eventual demise.
Spider's eventual demise, everybody could see this coming. And again, this is something I noticed this time around that I did not notice in previous viewings of this film is after Spider tells Tommy off, Spider looks absolutely terrified. He looks petrified as he's over mixing up drinks and stuff. He really, I think, immediately realizes he has made a mistake, but he's got to go with it. He's got to go with it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I know what you're going to say for the second time. He's got the bandage on his foot.
Right.
He's seen it all. He's world weary.
Yeah.
He's, that's where he gets to say, hey, why don't you go fuck yourself?
Right.
What worse? He's already shot him in the foot.
What worse could he do? But he's still petrified after he says.
But he feels like he has like this would have been Henry's fate had he not been so politically savvy. Because
right.
he and Spider indulges in the why don't you go fuck yourself because he's mad and he has a right to be. But he can't control that to the he knows he shouldn't say that, but he wants to because it feels good. And that was a bad choice. And everyone else is like, whoa, 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 everyone else around the table has now realized, Tommy's reputation, we're scared of him, but it's very clear as the movie progresses that the rest of the mob, this guy's a loose cannon too.
Right.
No one's down with what it's not like they're going to condemn him for it. It's like, I'll dig the fucking hole. I don't give a fuck. What is it, the first hole I dug?
Right. Where's the shovels?
Yeah, but he's being chastised, but it's like you're scolding a dog.
Right.
It's like, yeah, but I'll dig it. I know, whatever's made a mess, it'll be all right.
So then,
I went out of sequence. I had a few more notes on the Karen holding the gun.
More on that.
Yeah, just if you look at the, so she's got the voiceover during this, right? And, you know, says, well, I still couldn't hurt him. How could I hurt him? I couldn't even bring myself to leave him, right? And during this voiceover of explaining how basically, you know, as we realize that she's not, you know, he's got the upper hand. She's not going to leave him. She's upset with the situation, but it's a situation of her own devising, right? During her voiceover, you have close-up of her finger on the trigger of the gun, flexing the finger. Close-up of the hammer cocked back on the gun. Close-up of the barrel of the gun. This is a great thing to do while this voiceover is going on because it's you know, she's talking like, how could I leave him? Like, she's like at her therapist's office or talking to a girlfriend about it, and we're caught up in a situation where he is inches, millimeters from death. She's just like, but I just really want to fire this gun, right? You know, and at the very end, she says, why should I give him to someone else? Why should she win? I'm not doing my impression anymore. I'm sorry. And at the end, she feels possessive of this. This is my guy, you know? Her relationship with Henry is weird, but it's her trying to explain to the audience, why wouldn't she leave him? Why would you put up with this, right? Let's see. Yeah, you already did the thing with Jimmy and Polly trying to say, you know, you gotta settle this.
Yeah. Go down to Florida. Come back. Go back to Karen.
You gotta do it.
We're not in Mali.
In the meantime, Jimmy and Tommy are going down to Tampa this weekend to pick up something for me. Instead, you go with Jimmy.
Yeah, you come with me. We'll go down there, okay?
Have a good time. Take some time for yourself. Relax. Sit in the sun. Take a couple of days off.
Overtime.
Enjoy yourselves. And when you come back, you go back to Karen. Huh? Okay. Please, there's no other way. You're not going to get a divorce. We're not on the Mali.
I'm going to get a divorce. She'll never divorce him.
And she said, you know, she'll never divorce him. She'll kill him, but she won't divorce him.
And then I think the next, this is sort of, they go down to Florida, and Tampa specifically, and they beat up the guy. I forget why were they beating him up? What were they trying to get out of him? Doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, it's the day at work,
but it turns out that guy knew somebody in the FBI or something like that, and it got his sister was in something, his sister's boyfriend, whatever it was. Somehow, it winds up with Henry going to jail.
Yeah, and that's the part of this message of the Goodfellas, the prosaic reality of organized crimes. Sometimes you just get unlucky, and the guy you're roughing up has a sister in the FBI. Can you believe it? And you end up going to jail. You know, it's not like
a typist. The chat room says she was a typist for the FBI.
Yeah, whatever a typist is. Yeah.
A job that has been obsoleted by computers, probably.
Some more fun camera work because they have the voiceover. They must really feed each other to the lions down here, you know, and they show them being put over in the lion pit and they have the camera upside down showing the lion standing there.
Right.
It's just having fun. Every scene is not, you know,
why just shoot the lion? Why not show it upside down?
Why have a lion at all? You don't need a lion in this movie. You just show him being put into the cage and him screaming. No, you got to have the lion. It's got to be upside down. Right. He's got to be sitting there what?
It's so great.
Yeah. And so with Henry going off to jail, you know, the judge gave us 10 years like he was giving out candy, you know. Now bring me to jail. And then you show Henry dry swallowing some pills. This is the first time we see him doing any pills. So now we're switching into the drug section of the movie.
Right. Don't put too much onions in the sauce.
Yeah, and you're switching off of like his marriage, his family life, not too great. It's interfering with his work life. His work life got screwed, and now he's onto the drug. So he's going down. Yeah, and so the scene in the jail is kind of like a vacation for everybody involved.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you get the impression that they don't really want to be there, but they're wearing bathrobes, you know, their tracksuits. They're just
it's a break
chilling.
From work.
Yeah,
it's a break from work. You don't have to be. You know, they're still hustling, and Henry's definitely hustling inside jail, and he's got the drug problem building up. But the other guys are like, yeah, now we got time to eat.
Right.
You have
enough time to, you know, cut garlic with a razor blade so that it liquefies.
Yeah, and my comment is that I love seeing close-ups of food. Again, they're lingering on the food here. Who the hell cares how they cut garlic for the sauce? Is that part of the movie? Is that, you know? It's because it's part of the culture, and it's important enough that you're not just going to show it in the background, like. There's a close-up of garlic with a razor blade going down on it. But what mob movie has that? I mean, they make sauce in The Godfather. You don't see close-ups of garlic lovingly shot like it's a food show.
Right.
Right. Although I will say that I do not endorse the cutting the garlic so it disintegrates with a razor blade technique. But I don't even know if that's a real technique. I feel it is unnecessary. Just for the people who might not know, would think that's, you know, you have to do that to get good sauce. You don't.
all mixed together, living like pigs.
Yeah, and the song for that one, Under the Sea.
Yeah.
During that scene.
It's a great song.
Yeah, and I always felt he used too many onions, but it was a good sauce. That is the Italian / Jewish axis of reality. Always a complaint, always talking about food.
Right.
And this also rings true. But there's some commentary on, everyone's going to have a comment on the sauce, a little too many onions. You got to always talk about it. It's important. It's not just like, just accept it the way it is, right?
Right.
Always a complaint. Yeah, some more fun camera work when Karen comes to visit them in jail.
When she's looking at the roster?
She's looking at the address book.
Yeah.
They do the rotation. She's turning the register around to look at it, and the camera does the... Right. Showing it turned around. She's scanning. She's looking for Janice, right?
Yeah, and finds her.
Yeah. It's like,
I can't control who comes to see me. Yeah. I'm in jail.
Where am I? I'm in jail. We're out here on our own. I don't want to hear a word about her, Henry. Never. And this, by this point, you don't believe Henry.
No.
A word saying to his wife about that, And so then they do... 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think the jail thing was like, we're ramping up, and then decompress.
Right.
You see Karen outside. She's not doing well. Inside, he's trying to do his thing. It's just like a break. They do it, and they do a skip over, right? With him coming out of jail. Daddy, we missed you,
Karen, get packed. We're moving out of here.
Yeah. Well, while the kids are saying, Daddy, we missed you, and having the
reunion.
Reunion with that, the camera is not on. Them talking about,
right.
What they're doing, stuff like that.
It's on the pitiful squalor of their studio apartment.
Well, the camera's spreading over like the bunk beds,
right.
The kids' rooms, like this domestic, normal, non, mobbed out house life is what they were doing. And then he's looking around. He's like, we're out of here.
Right. But it's also like a one room studio. And he's like, we're not living like this anymore.
Yeah. It's his triumphant return because he's been working inside to get his drug deals and everything.
Right.
Going on there,
and then they go over, and he's like, all right, we're getting out of it. And then I forget what the line is that he says, but hey, let's go to Paulie's or something like that. And then you've got that great cut.
Wants to go to Uncle Paulie's?
Yeah.
Yay!
The music, the swelling music with the big plate of food coming out, and you get this like, now he's back,
yeah, it's back in the life. But he's got the secret, because you have that scene with him and Paulie. It was like, stay away from the garbage, inside you had to do what you do. And he smacks him. Paulie smacks him. It's like,
what shit? What are you talking about?
Just stay away from the garbage, you know what I mean?
What, Paulie?
I'm not talking about what you did inside. You did what you had to do. I'm talking about now. From now, here and now.
Paulie, why would I want to get into that?
Don't make a jerk out of me. Just don't do it. Just don't do it.
Right. And I read about that. Apparently, that was ad-libbed, and Henry's shocked reaction to it was totally true shock. He was really not expecting it. But
yeah,
what a great scene.
Jumps. Yeah.
And you
already know at this point, Henry's not, he's lying to to Paulie's face about
right.
this.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
It's like he's in too deep.
Way too deep. And so then he is now making money, good money again from the illegal drug sales. And you don't hear this again. You don't hear this by... In the typical way you would imagine is like a shot of him driving a big car or gambling again. No, you have Karen giving Maury and his wife Belle a tour of their house. And one of my favorite lines in the movie, just because it's so funny.
Can I guess it?
Yes.
Oh, I'm not going to get it. The one I have written in my notes is different. Go ahead. I'll tell you if it was the one I had.
So this is Karen talking to Belle, and she says, this we just had to have made special. Go ahead, sit in it, Belle. The others... You couldn't
That's
even sit
line.
In. Watch the wall with the rock.
And this we just had to have made special. Go ahead, sit in it, Belle. The others, you couldn't even sit in them. Okay, you ready? Watch the wall with the rock.
I have both of those lines, one above the other, in quotes. You ready? Watch the wall. The others, you couldn't even sit.
Yeah. You couldn't even sit in them.
Right.
And she's immediately, it just said that line says so much, because first of all, they had a sofa made special. First of all, who has I know some pretty rich people. I don't think they even get their sofas made special.
And everything's so tasteful.
It's
too, right?
So tasteful. Oh yeah. But here's the thing. The others you couldn't even sit in. They've had multiple sofas. None of them met with their standards.
The right
So each of the other sofas were sent back, and then they had to have this one made special. It's great. It's just such a great line.
Touch the wall with The Rock with more smooth camera moves. And the thing is, like, I don't know why other directors are so don't want to do this. Like, I don't. They watch the wall with The Rock, and then there would be a cut, and you would get a shot of the wall with The Rock,
right?
Instead of doing a pan,
right?
I think it's hard to do the pan.
Is it? It must be hard to do the pan.
Not get all dizzy. Not make people dizzy, and to keep continuity and to like make it smooth and not make it like, what, you know, like Blair Witch, like why are you whipping the camera around so much,
right?
Know?
Yeah.
But he pulls it off.
It and makes so you feel like you're in the room with the people and not watching a movie. That's what
right,
it does.
Is you're turning your head to do what she said, which is watch the wall with The Rock. Yeah. Lufthansa heist. This is the beginning of this. The beginning of the endish.
Yes. We're almost there. 140 minutes in.
Yeah. We get Stax Edwards, Samuel L. Jackson, yes. Big star.
Everybody loved Stax.
Not a big role, but he's there.
Yeah, he is in there. Was he a big star at this point?
I think he was bigger than his role indicates, but they just wanted to have him in the movie because who wants
Stax? Everyone loves Stax.
Yeah. And so you got them planning the heist and everything, right?
Maury.
And the heist is pulled off. I don't have any notes in this whole section.
Neither do I. You know what I have for this section? One word with an exclamation point after it. Carbone. Because this is where he gets to really shine for all of 30 seconds.
Oh, we did skip over you got the psychedelic 60s music with Sandy doing the mothballs of coke and everything.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The middle section is like clearly, you know, psychedelic drug culture, the two of them, you know, with the cocaine everywhere.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. So that's going on the background of the Lufthansa heist. My first note after the Lufthansa heist is Henry in the shower hearing about it.
Yeah, I have that too.
On the radio.
Port Authority police say $4 million. The city cops say $5 million. Lufthansa
cops said anything.
Live from the scene of the heist at JFK. It looks like a big one, maybe the biggest this town has ever seen. Stay tuned.
I don't know if that's the 1010 Winds music or not, or maybe I'm just misremembering because I haven't heard 1010 Winds in forever. 1010 Winds is a news radio, a news radio program in the New York area, and that's where he heals about it, because, you know, that's how you work the deal. You know, he's not the one out there stealing the stuff at this point. He's too high up for that. He's organizing it, getting it together, and, you know, they pull it off, right?
Right.
And then you go to Jimmy with his arms out with Frosty the Snowman playing.
Yeah.
Come here. And the camera's moving. And I'm, come on. He's the happiest guy in the world.
Right. And then you have the different guys, including Carbone and I forget the other guy's name, who show up. One guy bought his wife the big white Cadillac. And then Carbone shows up. His wife's wearing a $20,000 mink. He's like, I told you don't buy anything. What'd I tell you?
Yeah. And when on the mink scene, they had Baby Please Come Home playing in the background of that. And then they have the Tommy's girlfriend talking to the other person at the bar. And this is another great thing. If I even look at anyone else, he'll kill me. And the other thing is, that's great.
Yeah.
And then you can tell she's kind of like, that's honey, that's not great.
Yeah.
And then so they're talking about, oh, you can't buy expensive things. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I know. You know, we see all these guys messing up. The pink Cadillac, the mink. Jimmy's all pissed. Talks to Henry. Henry, you know, you're the sensible guy. You know we can't do this. And the next scene is, I got the most expensive tree they had.
Right.
It's in the house.
It's funny because he's, again, but you, a lot of the things that you said about Henry are really evident in that scene, in that, you know, he's trying to spend as much money as he can within the limits that Jimmy has set up. So, well, of course, it's Christmas time. Of course, I need a Christmas tree. So I bought the most expensive one they had. But he knows that that won't be. He's not breaking Jimmy's rules.
Well, he thinks he's working within them, but he's clearly not, because he gets jewelry for Karen and cash.
Right.
And like, it shows he's slipping. And the old Henry, who was at it more together, who wasn't on drugs, would have been better able to gauge. What I mean, he's smart enough to know you don't bring that, you don't flaunt it in front of Jimmy, because how stupid is that? You don't bring the pink Cadillac with you, or have your wife wear the mink coat. But he's still spending, you know, more than Jimmy would like, let's say. And so Stax is the first one to go on this, because Jimmy has got all this money. Once
now,
he has
Tom,
it, like,
Tommy that whacks
the wall.
Stax, right? Tommy shows up with Carbone in his little apartment.
Because he's the most expendable. He's, you know...
I think they were... he was sort of... Here's the way I read this, is Stax actually screwed up Like, yeah, he was supposed to do something. What was he supposed to do?
Supposed with the, to dump the truck
dump
somewhere.
Dump the truck and get it compacted. And
instead, he got high and forgot all about it or something.
Right. So Tommy and Carbone go to whack him. Carbone, again, this is probably his shining moment in the movie. He says, "I make the coffee to go." He's like, "Oh, all right." And he's walking around with the coffee. He's like, "What are you doing with the coffee?" He said, "Make it." Yeah. So anyway, they whack Stax. And then this is a really good scene that comes up. Is a scene where Jimmy, it is a turning point for Jimmy. You've got Jimmy sitting in the bar.
But before you do Jimmy's turning point scene, I got a couple notes on Stax getting whacked.
More.
Yeah. Okay. Just a couple notes on the way that shot. Right?
Oh, because it's a very good shot.
Yeah. You'll be late for your own fucking funeral.
Yeah.
He gets shot in the back of the head by Tommy, who doesn't care because what the hell, he's killing, you know, whatever. He's shot in the back of the head with a silenced pistol sitting in front of his bed. The amount of blood that appears in that bed, I would assume, I don't know anything about shooting people in the head, but I would assume that is a ridiculously unrealistic amount of blood that covers the bed as if like a gallon of blood had just been splattered on it through a spray gun.
Yeah.
Brutal, but it's artistic license. Brutal, right? And so you see that happen, and then you get the whole thing with the coffee, which is funny, but also tense because you're like, you can tell that poor Carbone now knows he's hanging out with Tommy. He can't handle it. His nerves are on edge. Then they go back during the voiceover saying Stax was always crazy. Instead of getting rid of the truck like he was supposed to, because the reason the shot in the back of the head works is you don't know. The voiceover hasn't explained that he screwed up. You could assume that they're there to kill him.
Right.
But you don't know. So while Henry's voiceover is explaining that he should have gotten rid of the truck, he went to his girlfriend's house and everything, and the cops found the truck and everything like that. While Henry is explaining that, they show the assassination again
from another angle,
in slow motion, from a different angle, showing the gun firing with the reverberating shots going out with Christmas music playing in the background. That's the type of, you know, that makes, instead of just having the scene where it's like, if you just play it straight and it's like a spy movie, you go in and you shoot the guy and, oh, isn't it brutal? They just got shot. This is the extra, the extra degree of difficulty, showing the master at work who's going to bring you back to what you already saw from a different angle, but the Christmas music and the voiceover explaining what you saw. I love that little sequence. So even though Samuel L. Jackson doesn't do much in this movie, he gets his due.
A good death.
Yes. And so this is, you were on the Sunshine of Your Love scene, right?
Yeah. This has always been one of my favorite movies. So this song was back on the charts. It's like a 10-year-old song at this point, which is kind of interesting. You've got De Niro, Jimmy, sitting there, turns, and he's smoking a cigarette. Again, nobody can smoke a cigarette like De Niro. And for 1 second, he gets this. And you hardly see De Niro smile in this movie. You see him smile a lot in the beginning when they're first introducing him. And when there's like a big to-do, he smiles. But he's alone this time. And he's sitting there, he's looking. And I think there's a shot where it shows, you know, people kind of milling about around in there. Because it's like at the bar and a lot of the other guys that were involved in the Lufthansa heist are there. And it shows him, and he gets, it's in slow motion, he gets this crazy smile for all of about a second and a half. And it's at that moment, and I've actually, I've read recently an interview with Scorsese that actually said this is when the exact moment that he decides he's going to start killing everybody. But it's almost like Stax getting killed, which kind of had to happen because Stax screwed up. None of the other guys screwed up.
Yeah, that was normal business.
That was just business.
But he had to, like I said, possession is 9/10 of the law.
Right.
I got the money.
Right.
Why do I have to give it to anybody?
Right. We killed Stax. I mean, what are these other guys? We don't need these. You know, and so you see this smile kind of come and then go just as quickly. And you realize that's when he decided, no, I'm going to kill all these guys.
And it's not hard because there's always a reason, right? Yeah. He's already pissed off these guys for various reasons. Yeah. It's not hard to come up with a reason that these guys should go.
Right.
And to convince his pals that, you know, I mean, Maury, geez, the head of the audience wants Maury dead at this point.
Yeah, I think Maury tells his wife everything.
Yeah, right. No, that's right.
I think Maury tells his wife everything.
Maury, him?
But, you know, and then you get the Layla montage, another famous sequence in the movie where the bodies, you may have more before this part, but the bodies turn up.
Yep, with the music, the kids slowly walking up to it.
Yeah.
The piano part of Layla.
Yeah.
They're on the ground as the dead passengers. I mean, you got to see the, you know.
Carbone frozen solid. You get to see the guys rolling out of the trash truck. Bodies.
Yeah. The voiceover is there. It made him sick to turn the money over to the guys who stole it. He'd rather whack him.
Right.
And what was Henry's part? He says, anyway, I didn't care. I wasn't asking for anything.
Right.
Besides, Jimmy was making nice money with me, so I put through connections. Still, a month after the robbery, they were finding bodies all over. So here's Henry saying, as long as I'm not the one who's getting killed, what the hell do I care?
Right.
He's got his other thing going on the side. So Henry and Tommy are still tight, you know. It doesn't occur to Jimmy to immediately whack Tommy and Henry. Like, they're his guys.
Right. That's his survivor alliance. That's his final three.
Yeah. Exactly. And Henry's not like there begging him for money or anything like that. Henry's not bothering him at all. That's just what Jimmy wants. He's got his own thing. It's like, yeah, good. Henry doesn't bother me at all. He's got his own thing. He's not bugging me for money. And Tommy, you know, it's their relationship is a little bit strange, but it's not, you know, he's not bothering. Tommy's more concerned with image and what he's going to do and stuff like that than just trying to get all the money for himself. So he's happy with that, that setup. Yeah. And they all go.
May I go? And then I think this is next. This is next in my notes. Is you've got this great explanation finally after almost 2 hours.
The word Goodfellas.
The word Goodfellas is finally explained. Henry finally explains. We called each other. You probably have the line there. We called each other Goodfellas, right?
I don't have the exact dialogue, but yeah, it's. It's when in the context of talking about Tommy getting made,
right? Because they're now find out that Tommy, being a full blooded Italian,
like me, yes,
like you, is capable of being turned into a made guy, and perhaps being Italian, you should be the one to explain what that means.
Well, like I said, the voiceover explains it, you know, it says it's the highest honor they can give you. It means you belong to a family and a crew. Like, you know, you are, it's the reason killing Billy Batts was a big deal. It's like getting tenure.
You know, we always called each other good fellas. Like you'd say to somebody, you're going to like this guy. He's all right. He's a good fella. He's one of us. You understand? We were good fellas, wise guys. But Jimmy and I could never be made because we had Irish blood. It didn't even matter that my mother was Sicilian. To become a member of a crew, you've got to be 100% Italian so they can trace all your relatives back to the old country.
It's the mafia's tenure system.
See, it's the highest honor they can give you. It means you belong to a family and a crew. It means that nobody can fuck around with you. It also means you could fuck around with anybody just as long as they aren't also a member. It's like a license to steal. It's a license to do anything.
Well, what's doing it, Tom?
All right, thanks, Vinny. Hey, how many years ago was it you was made?
Nah, I'm an old man. 30 years ago.
30 years, huh?
Yeah.
Brings back a lot of memories.
And how?
Mike's Pete was a fucking pimple then, wasn't it?
As far as Jimmy was concerned, with Tommy being made, it was like we were all being made. We would now have one of our own as a member.
Right. You can be in the mob. You can be in the mafia and not be a made guy. And this is something that for me as a young kid watching this movie, I didn't know that. I assumed
mobster movies.
Well, no, and not really before
it was 1990. We weren't that old, right?
Yeah. And I'd seen a few, but I didn't know like how it worked. So the explanation of it was interesting to me is that, you know, becoming a made guy means that you're not completely untouchable, but you were different. You were different than, and that was what was sort of surprising to me. It was like, oh, you sort of assumed that Jimmy might have been a made guy, but really,
no, it can't be.
Yeah, and he couldn't be because he wasn't.
It was just a hoodlum. The whole thing with the made guys is that you can't kill, according to the rules, you can't kill them unless you get the okay from their crew, otherwise you're starting a war. Whereas if right. low-level thugs get off, it's, you know, not a big deal.
Yeah. So in the crew, was Paulie the only made guy then in that whole crew, or were maybe a couple of the other guys made guys?
Because no, when there was more. It's not just Paulie. he had his lieutenants. I mean, I don't think it was just Paulie at all. It was, okay. It was some other people. We mostly hung out with Henry and his friends who were down at the thug level. And that's why they had to run side stuff, because Henry knew he could never be a made guy. So his drug thing was his thing. Right. You know, if he wants to progress in his career, so to speak, he's got to do it on his own. He's not going to be able to climb the ladder like Tommy. But then, you know, after this big explanation and Tommy getting all dressed up and the mother putting on the suit on him, he looks so nice.
Right. Be careful.
Right. He goes out there with all the people, and I can't remember the first time I saw this whether this caught me by surprise or not. Now I find it hard to believe that it ever did catch me by surprise, but I think it probably did, because it's cut together so well. Because you got the voiceover explaining the maid thing while you're seeing the video of him, you know, going up to, you know, do all the stuff with you know, the people are taking him to what you hope is going to be some kind of ceremony or something, and everything looks kosher right up until the point. Where they switch to the overhead shot, which reminded me of Taxi Driver a little bit, the end of Taxi Driver.
Oh, yeah.
Of the, you know, he opens the door and the room is empty. There's nobody there. And he
says, just like a card table.
And that's as much as Tommy gets out of his mouth. As soon as Tommy sees the empty room, he knows that he's dead. He gets half of oh no at him. Oh no. Boom. Back of the head. Flop down on the floor from the overhead shot with the mosaic tile pattern on it and the blood just spreading.
Yeah.
And the other maid guy goes, and that's that. And, you know, Henry's like, because among the Italians, it was real greaseball shit.
Right. We had a problem and he's gone.
Yeah, that's right. we had a problem. Like the car broke down.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a problem. We did everything we could and he's gone. He's gone. and then you get De Niro smashing the phone. And then the rest of the movie is about drugs.
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah, you got him. And the thing is, you see Jimmy pissed off in there, and it's like, Jimmy's pissed off because in his weird, twisted, sociopathic way.
This is bad for him.
Yeah, but it's also, because career-wise, that was his in.
Yeah. It was his friend, but the main thing is, this is, well, because he thought he was going to have it made for his retirement. He thought he was going to be working for Tommy, and no problem.
That's the end of that. And so the next, is it a title card or text on the screen comes up? Sunday, May 11th, 1980, 6:55 a.m.
Right, more granular.
So this next part of the movie, this entire ending sequence of the movie, is basically a miniature movie. You don't even have to have seen the other part of the movie to appreciate how this is put together, right?
Right.
You know, they put everything in place. You got a paper bag of guns. You got Henry coked up. You got a helicopter. You got a voiceover explaining what his plans for the day are. This will be, you know, this day, this one day, it's like an episode of 24 in a mutant world, right? You got all those pieces in place, and they play out with the voiceover, with just, you know, all coming to a head. You also have, by the way, Clay Davis, shit, from The Wire, makes an appearance. He's the doctor. When he goes to pick up, Henry picks up his brother in the wheelchair, or the places, Clay Davis, the doctor. Not quite as a memorable role, but he's there, you know. And you've got the people back at the house making the sauce. Now, people might think that's silly that, oh, you got another food segment and we're making the sauce. And he's like, you know, you stirring the sauce? I'm stirring it. That sounds
I'm stirring
like, you know,
it.
Isn't it funny that they think, you know, they have to pay so much attention to those? Let me tell you, I already talked about the razors and the garlic thing. You do actually have to stir the sauce. And it's not that it's going to stick. What they mean by that is that if your bottom of your pan is not thick enough, or even if it is, if you've got a hot spot in there and it starts to burn the tomato sauce at the bottom of the thing, because it's very difficult to bring like many, many gallons of tomato sauce to a boil.
Yeah, you got
to
keep it moving.
You got to do it slowly, and you can't have hot spots, because if you get a little part of it burn, the whole thing is bad. And so it's not so much the stirring of the sauce, but you're not trying to keep it from sticking, as if too much stuff gets in contact with the bottom, it will stick. You need to stir it to evenly distribute the heat, because you want the temperature of the sauce to rise together and not have a little hot spot on the bottom. And the solid parts of the tomato sauce is like liquid, and the little pieces of tomato will settle to the bottom and land on that hot spot and burn to it. That's very bad. So the all-day cook, slow-cooking tomato sauce thing that needs to be stirred, this is an actual thing that happens in real families. Of during the day when you make sauce, which is usually a Saturday or Sunday, someone has to be constantly stirring it. That is totally 100% true. And in all Italian families, people are like, did you stir the sauce? When's the last time you stirred the sauce? Have you been stirring the sauce? This happens in my house to this day. It happens in millions of people's houses. So this is not a crazy device in the movie that this coked up guy is like, got to do all the stuff for his mob stuff. And he's also worried about whether his brother's still stirring the sauce. It's a legitimate concern.
Mm-hmm. So this is when they start seeing the helicopter. And
we don't know if he's crazy at this point. We see he's coked up.
He's totally coked up.
There is a helicopter, but is it following him?
Right. Is it really following him? And then Karen also sees it, which doesn't make us feel any like they're any more reliable.
Yeah, I see it. It's funny. Okay, it's funny.
Yeah.
But she's not convinced, and we're not convinced. And this is, you know.
And then you've got another critical character who we haven't even mentioned yet, who is the babysitter slash drug mule.
Do you know that actress's name? She was great in this.
I don't know. I can look it up. Maybe I'll be able to find it before we get the end of the show. But yeah, she's great in this. And the way she delivers the one line where she's like, I don't have my lucky hat. I gotta go with my hat. I won't fly without it. I mean, it's like,
Lois, do you understand what we're involved in here?
I don't care. I need my hat. I won't fly without it.
She realizes that she really is like the linchpin for what's going on.
She realizes it or not, she's so self-centered. That, yeah. This is, you know, but I have the line. I need it. I got to have it. It's my lucky hat. I never fly without
right.
it. And this is like dealing with the babysitter whether she knows it or not, like, you know, she's decided that this concern of hers trumps everything else in everybody else's life because she is selfish, and dealing with a petulant teenager or whatever. It's like the more of the prosaic trials of the real life criminal.
Right. That's right.
On the phone with this babysitter, and she's giving me, like, I got to do all this stuff. And the babysitter, too. Fine. We'll get that.
Yeah. Fine. We'll get it. He grabs his keys, goes out, and he gets into his car, and then the police are there.
Yeah. Freeze. Don't you move, you motherfucker. I'll blow your brains out. Shut the car off slowly.
Freeze. Don't you move, you motherfucker. I'll blow your brains out. Shut the car off slowly.
Got the voiceover. I have this and thing. For a second, I thought I was dead. But when I heard all the noise, I knew they were cops. Now, the comment I want to say about this scene is when he goes into his car, I wish I could cue this up. I'm having trouble with scrubbing here. If you look closely, you can see red and blue lights flashing.
Yeah, already flashing.
Against
but he's
back.
Coked he up, man. He's coked up.
He doesn't see them yet, but you see them. So if you're watching closely, you'd be like, oh, red and blue lights, right? So you know it's the cops, right?
Right.
And the line is, only cops talk that way. If they'd been wise guys, I wouldn't have heard a thing. I would have been dead. And then you got the cocaine in the toilet, the giant gun in Lorraine Bracco's panties. And then you get the title card that doesn't have a date on it. It just says, The Aftermath.
Right.
So that all...
And then he says, the narration is, this is the bad time.
Yeah. And that section, that mini movie, we skipped over many things in there, but it really is like a, you know, a little miniature play with
great
a bunch
music,
of
a lot of Rolling Stones, a lot of Muddy Waters, I think. You get a lot of great musical cuts and things spliced together that shows how frenetic it really is for him. Yeah. And what I imagine being coked up would probably be like the paranoia, it's crazy.
And such a departure from the earlier part of the movie when Henry was like the, you know, really did have it under control. This is Henry losing control, trying to keep it under control, but the drugs are not letting him, and he's just off the reservation. I think that's also in that sequence. They have Sandy throwing a big bag of cocaine at him and getting pissed because he leaves because he said he was going to stay. Yeah.
So this is the bad time. And he's trying to figure out what to do. He obviously doesn't have any money anymore because Karen has flushed the $60,000 worth of coke down the toilet, and they have that sort of, this is the time when you really see Henry completely falling apart.
The two of them are crying on the floor practically.
Yeah. And you know, this is where she shouts, I'm sorry. And he's like, how could you do that?
Yeah.
We needed that. I was counting on that. How could you do that, Karen? And of course she is sorry about it. They would have found it, but they would have. They were in everything. They wouldn't have found it, Karen. Do you think they would have found it?
They would have found it.
I think they totally would have found it.
Of course they would have, but like he's mad at her, but then eventually he quickly switches over to just being, you know, abject sadness.
Yeah, just purely shutting down. And then he has to go to Pauly.
Yeah.
Who he lied to about doing this stuff. And here Pauly is totally... you know, pissed off at him and hands him whatever it was,
$3,200 for a lifetime.
Yeah. Now I got to turn my back on you. Now, what is the significance here of Pauly cooking the sausages, plumping up, roasting them in the frying pan.
But you see that he's, my take on it is that this guy who we haven't seen really getting too angry or anything, like, he's broken up about this. Paulie's personality is not the type to be expressive, but there's like this simmering rage and disappointment, right, and everything inside him, like the same way the juices inside that sausage are.
Right. And that Henry is the sausage, and he is now cooking Henry, maybe. No.
I think more of the simmering rage, but simmering also mostly rage. Just because Paulie is always associated with food, and what else would he be doing with cooking himself some sausage?
But it also seemed to me like Paulie himself was sort of, the fact that he was now cooking his own food, not because he was in prison, but he sort of, he wasn't in a bathrobe, but he was in, like, he didn't look as dressed up as usual. He looked like he's fallen on maybe hard times too. Did you get that? He's kind of sweating.
I don't know. He's kind of in the back room. Like, this is where you kind of see the guy, that he's not like at the head of a big table with a big important person. He's cooking sausages in the back room. Anyway, kind of disheveled.
He gives Henry the money. And that's it.
Now, on this thing, if you think about it, like, Henry's coming hat in hand. Henry's coming, I'm very sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, he's going to try to make Paulie convinced that he is no longer lying to him about anything, which I'm pretty sure he didn't lie to him. Not that I think he would have been above it, but he's coming hat in hand. It's like, look, you know, I don't have anything. I got nothing. I'm sorry for what I did, everything like that. Had Paulie taken him in or given him money to flee, like, in the Choose Your Own Adventure version of this movie, Paulie made the wrong move here, because this guy is unreliable and is a liar. But if Paulie had, I'm not going to say done the right thing, but like, if Paulie had made a different choice and said, I will help you flee and make a different life somewhere else, in the hopes that he would go far away and probably die of a drug overdose or get into trouble somewhere else and just be disassociated with him, that would have been much better.
That would have saved Paulie and everybody else.
And I think Henry even would have kept his mouth shut.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he only ratted, as, you know, circling back to the never rat on your friends thing as a kid, because it was like everything else was gone. And so this was his second to last out. Henry's second to last play was go to Paulie, hat in hand, try to see what you can do. And that didn't work. And so the only thing left, if Paulie really knew Henry, he should have known that what's left for him. Because he's a survivor. He's not going to just get whacked on the street. It's not going to be that easy. You know what I mean? Maybe they thought they could get him in jail, but like, witness protection maybe never entered their mind, because they thought, you know, of course he's not going to do that.
No, he wouldn't do that. He's not going to rat.
Yeah, so that was a bad move on Paulie's part there.
So at some point shortly after this, Karen goes to Jimmy's store, like warehouse place, I guess under the pretense of picking up a coat or something.
Yeah, and she also goes underneath some really big shoulder pads.
Right. Yes.
On that leather jacket.
Very. And the understanding that, or what it seemed to convey in that scene,
is she gonna
is De Niro gonna kill her, and that's why he was having her go into
the most ominous room with guys stacking boxes.
Right, and as she's walking by, like, hold on,
it's in there. He does the little curve with the hand
in there. In, and she gets freaked out and runs away, and then you've got him just kind of looking a little pissed off. Now, here's my question for you, and I've asked a lot of people this question over the years. Was she just paranoid, or was he going to kill
her? Oh, no, he was going to kill her, 100%. 100%, he was going to kill her, no question. And so, and this is a good learning opportunity for practical concerns for people who are still listening. Her instincts are that this is a dangerous situation.
Yeah.
Her rational mind is saying, what the hell is dangerous about it? Jimmy gives me stuff all the time.
Right.
He's telling me to go in there. There's nothing. It's daylight. It's in the city. There's some people in there stacking boxes. Like, there's nothing. Your rational mind says you're just being crazy. But her instincts tell her, danger, flee.
Right.
And she correctly follows her instincts. And that's how people get into trouble, where they have an instinct where there's something wrong, but they feel like their rational mind says there's not, and giving into that instinct would make them look foolish.
Right. And they would rather, just listen to the feeling.
Listen to the instinct. If you're in a city or you're by yourself or whatever, and something tells you, you're worried about being foolish, better to be alive.
I would rather, and I'm the living example of this, I'd rather look like a fool than...
That's right. How to be a Coward, the 5x5 podcast.
Yeah.
But no, she's alive because of it.
Just run, and all of a sudden, all of our listeners will... You know, the next time they have to walk into an elevator and there's someone in there, all the 5x5 listeners will be fleeing the elevator now, screaming.
Yeah, that may be a good move.
Yeah.
And she tears out of there. And her, I think she's in a, is she in a Volvo?
Yeah, I think she is in like a Volvo and she tears, I've got something I'm going to do. And she's driving away.
Yeah. So this, I forget what sequence this comes in, but there's this other scene. I guess it's right after.
With De Niro in the diner?
Yeah. With De Niro. So they go to meet, it's Henry and Jimmy meeting in the diner.
And he gets there 15 minutes early and De Niro's, Jimmy's already there.
Now, the thing they do in this scene has been done in many, many movies. It gets a lot of fame for being done in this movie. I don't know if it was first, and I have no idea what the name of it is, but I do know how it's done, I believe. They show them sitting down. You're looking at them from the side of the table, you know, Jimmy on the left and Henry on the right or whatever it is. And they're in a diner right in front of the window, sitting by the window in a booth. And what they do with the scene is they, I don't know which one of these is. I'm just going to say it one way, and if it's the opposite way, just reverse it. They move the camera on tracks or whatever towards the actors, and at the same time they zoom out,
right,
so that the actors stay the same size even while the camera is moving. And the effect this has, because the lenses and other stuff that I don't understand, is that you see what looks like a static shot of two people talking. They're in the frame, they don't move in the frame, they're the same size in the frame the whole time, but the background appears to become closer, to come closer to them. It's because of, like, I don't know,
I can actually, this is one term I actually do know. This is called a dolly zoom.
A dolly zoom, right? Someone's saying it's popularized by Hitchcock.
Yes, in Vertigo.
And so, again, like the big Copacabana scene with the long single take shot, that effect has a purpose here. And Hitchcock did the same thing with a similar purpose, is that you're trying to convey that there's a realization going on, that the world is changing because of this conversation. This is when Henry realizes that he was, you know, that this is how he's going to be killed. They're going to, you know, send him off to do whatever. And
right.
That's when I knew I would never come back from Florida. Right. Right.
But it's the way that he does this zoom. Usually it's done with, like, to have really strong dramatic effect.
Really fast. Yeah, this
here,
is
it's very slow, gradual.
Yeah. And because it's the dawning realization that even Jimmy, even this, you know, I wasn't completely sure before, but, you know, and I wasn't there with Karen or anything, but now I know.
Right.
That's when I knew, right? The slow dawning realization through that camera move.
It's a great point.
And so then you go over to the witness protection program. And this is one of the my favorite parts of this movie is, right, so we go to the witness protection program, and you got them in, like, the what you assume is the government office building or whatever.
Right.
With the unnamed, I don't know, this guy, FBI guy or something.
But he's here's a neat little bit of trivia, is that that guy is Ed McDonald, and he played himself.
Is he an actual FBI person?
Edward A. McDonald is a former federal prosecutor who, as an attorney in charge of the Organized Crime Strike Force in New York, was repeatedly honored for his trial and supervision of some of the Justice Department's most important cases.
Hmm. Well, there you go.
It's still
the
practicing.
Trick of the wire. Get the real people to do it.
Why not?
The reason the scene stands out, because you've got Karen there with a cigarette and Henry looking disheveled and still kind of coked up on the couch, and they're both, you know, they're discussing the logistics and everything. And the witness protection guy sounds and looks like Mr. USA Justice.
I know.
After spending 2 hours with wise guys, right? You spent 2 hours in this world, that having this guy up there with, like, man, I speak like an American without an accent, and I'm part of, he's like a superhero. He's like,
right,
super friend. And you don't realize how inoculated you had become to this world of mobsters. You become accustomed to it. And of course, you know, people who are used to that world are already accustomed to it. It's just such a jarring change. It's like, you know, you're in a different world now.
Yeah.
You know?
You're like in the world, and all of a sudden Henry is in our world. In the world of, like, law abiding citizens who,
Captain America.
Yeah. Who like live in the real world and have jobs people that Henry is about to become, basically.
And he's still the same guy. He's like, no place cult. Come on, just whoever controls it. No, like, place cult.
If he's legitimately bronchial, we'll take that into consideration.
Right. You mentioned whenever you move me, I asked you once, and I'm going to tell you again, I don't want to go any place that's cold.
You really don't have a choice in that matter.
Ed, come on. Just whoever fucking controls it, just no place cold, all right? Do that for me.
He's bronchial, that's why.
Well, if he's legitimately bronchial, we'll take that into consideration.
Bronchial. Would you like to go someplace that's not cold?
Okay, can I ask you some questions here?
Whoever controls it. I love that line. But, you know, and this is when Karen also realizes that she kind of has to go into it with him, even though it means she won't see her parents, because they'll kill her. They'll kill the kids to get to him.
Yeah.
So, I don't know anything like Karen. Come on. We've listened to the tapes. You know a lot.
Yeah, and while he's talking to them, they're interspersing it with the scenes of other guys, otherwise guys being taken off in handcuffs.
Right, De Niro and everybody else pretty much being brought in.
One of the guys gets, I think maybe it was Tutty, gets in the shot. You know, whoever sold you those suits had a wonderful sense of humor on his way out. It's still the wise guy to the last.
Right, and it's funny because, you know, there's the one cop in there. He's like, you know, totally baiting him. You know, totally when Henry is arrested before all this, we forgot to mention it, how the one guy's like, they bring in Henry's stash of cocaine, and the one cop, who by the way is like the perfect definitive cop, he's got like the gray hair and the funny like Weasley sort of grin, and he's like the perfect like detective, you know, and he tastes the cocaine, he looks up and he smiles, he's like, bye, you know. It's so funny, they just hate these guys so much.
In the courtroom scene, you got the voiceover. Yeah. He's saying how it was easy for us to disappear. I never voted. I never paid taxes.
Yeah, my social security card. It's amazing.
Yeah, and so then we're finally right around the scene you talked about, where he's on the stand talking about the stuff.
Yeah.
He's pointing to the people. Do you see him in the courtroom now? He points to him. Let the record show that he's pointed to. You know, and he, you know, you see all the people he's pointing to. He's betraying Jimmy. You know, they show Jimmy and all the people, and then he gets up. Maybe he's, you know, he starts. At this point, and now he's reminiscing. He's like, you know, while this stuff is going on between them, people call them rats because a rat will do anything to survive. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill? Objection, you know.
Yeah.
And he's not even there. He's like, anything I wanted was a phone call away, you know. Right. Like, what a life that it was for me. It's just, he still can't let go. He's like, I can't believe I'm leaving this behind, right? You know, and then he gets off. He's like, we had anything, you know. Everybody had their hand out. Everything was for the taking. And now it's all over.
Everybody had their hands out. Everything was for the taking. And now it's all over.
And he walks to the camera. And there's no way you do that. And if you do that in the first scene, you're like, oh, is that kind of movie, right? It's going to be a fourth wall breaking movie or whatever. This is not that kind of movie. It's like the only time they do it, basically. And it works because it's the only time, because they got you by this point.
But this just totally shows the great points that you've been making throughout this show today, is how expert Scorsese is at this stuff. And what's the one thing he hasn't done in the movie so far at this point?
He's got to show he can do it all.
He has not broken the fourth wall. Oh, yeah, I'll do that too. But you'll like it. You know, it's like he's rubbing it in your face now.
Yeah, he's a master at the top of his game.
Yeah, couldn't even get decent food.
And that's the hardest part. Today, everything's different. There's no action. I have to wait around like everyone else. You can't even get decent food. Right after I got here, I ordered some spaghetti with marinara sauce, and I got egg noodles and ketchup. I'm an average nobody. I got to live the rest of my life like a schnook. Why would you... all right, so we know he's a nobody. We know he's not like the big riding high on the hog, can do anything, can get the seat at the Copa Cabana. He's not a big deal anymore, right? He mentions the food because we had the whole movie pointing the food. And that rings true as well, because as someone who used to live in New York and grew up there and now lives in Massachusetts, which is not that far away, I constantly complain about the food items that I can't get or can't get as well in this area. You know, I can make my own sauce at least. I mean, he should have learned how to cook a little bit better. He did know how to make his own sauce. Doesn't make much sense. But yeah, you go there, you're like, oh, I'll order some spaghetti, and you get egg noodles and ketchup. You're not among your people anymore. They don't know what the hell that stuff really is, right? It rings true to the people in that environment, because if you grew up there and you move someplace else, that's a big factor in your life that now you can't get the food you liked.
And we talked about food being one of the consistent things that even in prison he had good food.
Yeah.
You know, and now he can't get it. He is truly out now. He really, and that's what hits home for him. It's not that his friends are gone and in prison. It's not that his life is screwed up. It's not that, but he can't get the food.
Yeah. And I'll now slag off everybody else who's not in New York and say that I always get the impression that people who grow up in the middle part of the country or whatever, who are used to like their parents cooking But then, like, they're used to, like, you know, I don't know, local things that are like restaurant chains and stuff. There's not a regional specialty that they can only get there. But if they were to move to a different state, you could just go to KFC and get KFC, and KFC is the same everywhere, right?
Right.
Just like I always felt like, well, I moved somewhere, there's bagel places everywhere. I can get bagels everywhere, right? Well, you can't. And that's the sad reality. If you are a young person listening to this and you live in the New York metro area or on Long Island or something, you just assume that no matter where you move in the country, you'll be able to go get pizza and bagels. They have pizza and bagels everywhere in the country. It's not the same. It's not the same. And I'm sure people from the West Coast feel the same way about, you know, the Mexican food or Chinese food or whatever regional specialties they have there. But that's a big factor in people's lives. I think it's a lot of reason why people don't like to move away from home or have some affection for home, because it's the one place you can get all the things you grew up with having, you know? Right.
Yeah. Like here, we got barbecue.
Yeah. Well, people from the South who are going to move up here and say, oh, I'll just go to a barbecue joint and get barbecue. They must feel the same pain.
You can't. You can't do it.
Yeah. And so the thing ends with, you know, I got to live the rest of my life like a schnook, right? And they do a quick cut to Tommy firing into the camera, loud bangs in the theater.
Right, facing right at the camera, pointing the gun at the camera.
And this is, Tommy's already dead. We know he's dead in the movie, but it still gets you. It's like, look, because you are afraid of this guy. And that's that visceral excitement is the life he left.
Right.
And he gets you with it, getting you to understand what his life was. Visceral, exciting, action-packed, dangerous. And now he's getting his paper in his bathrobe, eating egg noodles and ketchup. The end. And then after the end, they have the, you know, Hill is still in the witness protection program, and Paulie died in prison, and Jimmy's eligible for parole in 2004 when he'll be 78, right? And they play Lay Low over the credits, and, you know, it's kind of like the wrapping up,
right?
Whatever happened to these people. But it practically doesn't matter. At that point, you're curious to know, but you feel like you've been taken through a complete ride in this movie. Yeah, and I have the final notes I have in this movie. So I don't have a really good ranking of like my favorite movie, my second favorite movie, and my, you know, stuff like that. But Goodfellas is up there. It's tough because it has to necessarily contend with The Godfather 1 and 2. And so it's hard to even say Goodfellas is my favorite mob movie, right? Because, like, I don't know. That's a tough call. But those three movies are clearly like up there at the top of my list, fighting with like Empire Strikes Back or whatever to say that they are my favorite movies of all time. But but your favorite movies, this is a distinction that I always make that people don't like or seem to be confused by. What your favorite movie is isn't necessarily the same thing as, or for me anyway, my favorite movie is not the same thing as what I think is the best movie.
Sure.
Right? Because I have favorites that I like more than some other movie, but I can also recognize with, you know, the less subjective part of my mind that other movie is actually a better movie than this one that happens to be my favorite, because things can be your favorite for all sorts of reasons, right? But this movie is both. This is a great movie made by a great filmmaker doing everything right. It's a different kind of movie than The Godfather. It's a lot lighter than The Godfather, right? You're more likely to laugh out loud during this movie than during The Godfather. So it's difficult to say where this lands. Where do you rank this in your movies of all time, or in your mob movie pantheon?
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting point because a lot of people think what you said, which is, you know, oh, your favorite movie must mean you think it's the best. I think it's possible for you to think the movie is one of the best movies ever made and have it not be in your list of favorites. It's interesting because I watched this movie a lot when I was younger, and then I stopped watching it, and I hadn't seen it for many, many, many years. And then I watched it a number of times again, and most recently in preparation for this show. I think, you know, when I think about mob movies, for me, I really think of four movies: Godfather 1 and 2, Goodfellas, and Casino. There's something to me that's very, without, you know, we at some point might talk about some of those other movies. I feel like The Godfather presents a completely different aspect of the mob, in a sense that it's, you really feel like that's the high end of the mob. That's the aristocrat
mob. Well, that's one generation back.
Right, and a generation back, but also a higher level in a lot of ways, because that was at the top. And here you're almost from the bottom up.
Yeah.
You're starting with the guy who's not a made guy and can never be a made guy. A guy who starts out into it when he's in his early teens, as opposed to being born into the royal family, so to speak. So it prevents it. But I mean, gosh, there's so much about this movie to like. The subject matter of it is
almost
second,
doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's a secondary to it. It's certainly one what I feel is one of the best movies, certainly of our generation, perhaps of all time. As far as being one of my favorites, I mean, it's up there. It's up there. I think it's one of the all time great movies. And if you're looking at it from a cinema, you know, just from the pure cinema, from what did Scorsese do in this movie? I think it has everything. It's got it all. So I mean, I don't know. It's a tough one for me. Obviously, seeing it again after all these years and coming back to it, I remember all the things that I liked. I would probably, you know, I would probably put it up there. It'd probably be in the top five.
And, you know, when I think of this movie, the reason, even though it's a mobster movie and you're compelled to group it with other mobster movies, as you noted, like, that's not the defining character. I mean, it does have a special place because of those mob connections or the Italian family connections for me. But when I think of how the movie is made, the art of movie making on display here, the movie I connect it with a lot in my head is another movie that I like. And both of these movies I describe as having kinetic filmmaking. Now, maybe it's just because the camera moves a lot, and that's why the term kinetic keeps popping into my mind. But that other movie is Fight Club, which is not about organized crime at all. And, you know, a very different director. And they both have very different histories and, you know, different reputations. But I think if you put those movies side by side, maybe it's because they both have a voiceover and they both have a camera that moves in daring manners to further the story.
Right.
And they both confound expectations with what happens in the scenes and the tone of the scenes, the subject matter and the tone contrasting with each other. Those two I always lump together in my head. I think Goodfellas is definitely a better movie than Fight Club, but Fight Club I have a great affection for.
Well, then we'll have to put that one on our list, because that's one of my all-time favorites as well.
Yeah, and the biggest, the saddest sin of our society, our country, our this great land of ours, is that Dances with Wolves got the Oscar for Best Picture when this movie...
Yeah.
How can you... Scorsese, I'm surprised he didn't hang himself. How do you make this movie and then not get the Best Picture, the Best Director?
Yeah, I don't know.
How does that even happen? What universe? I mean, Dances with Wolves, it's bad because like people dump on Dances with Wolves. But Dances with Wolves is fine. I like Dances with Wolves, but you don't win. Like, Academy voters, I don't know what was going on there. Because seriously, and then you got to give him, what did he get the Oscar for? They gave him the pity Oscar for like not Donnie Brasco, for The Departed or something. What did they finally give Scorsese Best?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that after you said it. I knew you were going to ask me that. Was it The Departed that got it?
Whatever it wasn't Goodfellas. And it was clear that like people saw, oh no, we've made a terrible mistake. You know, years later, in hindsight, they realized, no, Dance with Wolves was fine and all.
Yeah.
The chapter says, yes, it was The Departed. And The Departed was a good movie too. But seriously, it's like the failure of, this is like, you know, a great artist not recognized in their time. Well, these days, we've advanced it to the point where they're recognizing their time, but only by the time they're like 70 and you give them the pity Oscar. It's a bad job, Academy, because this was the best movie that year. No, no contest. And certainly the best director. Who are you going to give best? I can't stand it. Did Costner get it for best director that year? I don't, it's not.
You know what? It doesn't matter who won what. We know which movie should have been.
Yeah. So what I actually love to hear is, I know that in lots of actual film schools, and I know Roger Ebert used to do this because he would, you know, have film school classes and stuff. They would take you through a movie shot by shot in an academic environment, using all the correct terms for everything and being academically rigorous and much more knowledgeable than either of us are. I would love to see someone do that with this movie, because we've given the laypersons, like, I've noticed from years of watching movies that they're doing these interesting things, but we have no idea what they are or what other things we might be missing. I would love to see a actual scholarly tour shot by shot through this movie, because I get the impression that there's a lot to learn in here. And I think in a scholarly environment, that's probably the environment when people would go, oh, this is showy and you really shouldn't need to do this and, you know, whatever. But I think you can pull it off, and I think he did pull it off.
Yeah.
3 hours and 15 minutes.
Is that it?
Do we think we covered it? Once you lay in the audio samples and everything, it'll expand out to an even 4 hours. We'll just need to go on across.
Well, think about it like this. We talked about the movie for approximately 30 minutes longer than the movie.
Yeah, the Incomparable, when we did The Empire Strikes Back, we had the same thing.
And you were the one that was saying it would be a problem to have us talking over the movie because it might go too long.
Yeah, no, I definitely would have. Because we talked a lot about scenes that were very short. True. Like, just, you know, small segments. Yeah.
I don't know.
It would be a lot of work to cut this together with the actual scenes from the movie and everything, but that's too much.
Yeah, no, I agree. But this was great. That was very good for, first episode.
Inaugural outing episode. Of 5x5 at the movies, asterisk, please don't sue us.
Right. So thanks for being here. So people need to hear about the regular show that we do together. It's called Hypercritical. You can go to 5x5.tv/hypercritical. And if you think this wasn't, John was barely conscious during this show. This is usually people in the chat room at the end were commenting that, oh, he's starting to wake up.
Well, that's because it's something I like. I get revved up about things I don't like, but
I can tell.
I think I also get revved up about things I do like. If you'd like to hear me talking more about a movie that I loved, listen to the episodes of The Incomparable, also at 5x5.tv/incomparable. We did two-part episodes on Star Wars, the original, and The Empire Strikes Back, and we will eventually do one on Return of the Jedi. Similar type of thing, movies that I really like. If you want to hear me yell about things that I don't like, then listen to
the 50 episodes of Hypercritical that await you. And but that's great. And people can follow you on Twitter, Syracusa, SIRACUSA on Twitter. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter. And we're glad you listened. Glad you tuned in. Glad you hung out for over 3 hours. And maybe they should go back and watch Goodfellas again.
Maybe. Or just start on The Godfather.
Or Fight Club. Yeah. All right, John. Talk to you soon.
You do, Dan. Bye.